Good afternoon. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is February 6th, 2017, and we're going to be spending the bulk of today's meeting on the issue of mining in-stream and upland. We'll have a public hearing on that. That's Senate Bill 3. But before we get to that, we have a couple of very quick work session items to get through. So I'm going to open a work session on to introduce a few committee members, committee measures.
Yeah. We got all the members
to introduce. I'm going to introduce our member here, our new member at the end. No.
If I'm a yes vote, I'm with you, Mr.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move that we move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. That would be LC 1925, dated 12/2/16, Legislative Council, or LC 1926, dated 1/2/12. Well, no, start over. About December 2nd, 2016, and then also LC 3307, dated 1/25/2017.
Okay, Senator Brzozinski has moved LC 1925, LC 1926, and LC 3307 that they be introduced as committee bills. And let me, I know you colleagues know, but just for the audience to know that the introduction of committee bills, our approval of the introduction of committee bills says nothing about how we feel about these bills. Whether they will even get a hearing in this committee, but it's just to enter them into the legislative process. So is there any discussion of this motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Although it's just to enter them into the process, I will still be a no on all three bills.
Thank you for that. So any further discussion? Yes, Senator Roblin.
I'll just say, although it's just for introduction, I will be a yes and all.
Okay. All right, you cancel each other out. Thank you. Okay, so is there anyone else that has opposition to these bills being entered as committee bills? Okay. Shelley, would you note that Senator Olson is a no, and otherwise the motion carries. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on introduction of committee measures and open a work session on Senate Bill 383. We heard this bill last Wednesday. Beth, you want to just remind us
Sure.
of what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 383 would appropriate $1.5 million to the Department of Environmental Quality to award grants for the purposes of developing a loan program for residential or small business on-site septic system repair, replacement, or evaluation. There is a fiscal impact statement on OLIS and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. And this bill, if we pass it, will go to Ways and Means.
Correct.
Right? Yeah. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Dimbrough, I move Senate Bill 383 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Olson has moved Senate Bill 383 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the this motion? Seeing none, motion carries. This bill will go to Ways and Means. Thank you. And Senator Roblin, again, thank you for bringing it to us.
Yep.
Okay, so with that, I will close the work session. And let's open our public hearing on Senate Bill 3. And Beth, would you please tell us what this bill is?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 3 would do a number of things. So I'll just briefly summarize. First, it would add habitat essential to the recovery and conservation of Pacific lamprey to the areas covered by the existing moratorium on motorized placer mining that's in effect until January 1 of 2021. Effective January 2nd of 2019, it would remove upland areas from that moratorium and establish a permit requirement for upland motorized placer mining. Third, on effective January 3rd, 2021, it would require a permit under the removal fill laws for motorized in-stream placer mining and a permit under water quality laws for discharges to waters of the state from that type of mining. Finally, it would apply the invasive species check station law to anyone transporting motorized equipment that's used for in-stream placer mining. We don't yet have any fiscal revenue impact statements on this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Beth. And colleagues, I'm sure this bill sounds familiar to you. We've been wrestling with this concept for a while, starting in 2013 with Senate Bill 838. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that, there was a task force that was created that was authorized by Senate Bill 838. That coincided with the period that I was chairing this committee, so I got to participate in some of those fascinating meetings. The result of that task force was a bill that we saw in 2015 and then again in 2016. And here we are trying to coming back to this issue, and I hope resolving it this session. So to start us off with this discussion, I'd like to call up Senator Courtney and Julie McFadden, please. Senator, thank you for bringing this bill.
Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the Environment and Natural Resources Senate Committee. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem and on up to Jervis and Woodburn. I live in Salem. My testimony is very direct and very simple. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 3, a bill that I introduced. I think you all know where this bill comes from. This isn't a bill I would normally be bringing before this august committee. Not because it's not an important issue, it is, but because this bill is not my bill. This bill belongs to Senator, the late Senator Alan Bates. As Oregon Senate President, Senate Bills 1 through 10 belong to me. Now, I better explain that. It comes across as totally an egotistical remark. I get to choose which bills are given those numbers. This bill is Senate Bill 3 to honor Senator Alan Bates, who represented Senate District 3 in the Oregon Legislature. Others here today will tell you how this bill is good policy, that it protects Oregon streams, rivers, and fish. This bill also recognizes and emphasizes all that the late Senator Alan Bates did to protect Oregon's treasured waterways and to preserve the natural habitat of the mighty salmon. Thank you for hearing my testimony here today, and I look forward to the work of this august committee, as hopefully we can find a way to move it to the Senate floor so we can have a bold and bipartisan vote. Thank you, Senator Dumbrough.
Thank you very much, Senator. And before I call on Julie, just want to point out that we're joined by Senators Boquist and Girard, who have also been living with this issue for quite a while. Thank you. Julie, welcome.
Hi, Chair Dimbrough. Members of the committee, my name is Julie McFadden, and I served as Chief of Staff for Senator Alan Bates during the last two sessions, and I worked with him on the development of what is now SB 3. I'm truly honored to be here today, and I thank you for this opportunity. I also want to thank President Courtney for sponsoring this bill and for he and Interim Senator Talbert for letting me work on SB 3 all the way up until January 8th. This bill, I just want to give a bit of an overview, really, of kind of high-level overview of the process of the bill since I've been working on it, as well as Senator Bates' intentions. I'm a little nervous because that.
Oh. Senator Bates was, this bill started in 2013 with the increase of mining that we saw on the rivers, especially down in Senator Bates's district. We saw conflicts that I'm sure you've heard much about, concerns arose, and there were identified to be some loopholes. Thank you. Loopholes that he identified in the legislation that he felt could really help, that needed to be closed up. So he was not pursuing a full moratorium. He was not trying to get miners off of the rivers. Senator Bates instead I think it's because you did such a good job of introducing him that I'm so emotional. I just
You're doing good.
There's pitch hitters, maybe there's pitch speakers. he was doing what he does so well, which is trying to thread the needle. He wanted to find that middle road so that we could have miners enjoying the waters, but in a way that doesn't impact the rights and enjoyment of everyone else, and also doesn't impact the investment that Oregon has in essential salmon right habitat. We picked up the bill in after the work group had finished its work. It did not come to consensus. The governor's office then took the materials from that work session, came forward with a bill, and Senator Bates started to convene his work group. The work group involved Republicans. We had representation from the miners. We had DOGAMI, DEQ, DSL. We had representation from the environmental community. It was inclusive, as was Senator Bates's nature to do. He strove for bipartisanship, and he also was striving for a bill that was just good policy. Even after we had heard that consensus was not going to be possible, he continued to invite the mining interests and everyone to the meetings because he wanted to have industry input and make sure that the policy was as strong as it could be. He had an open door throughout this policy and was willing to try to find ways to make this happen. So this bill was comprehensive not only in process but also in policy. He did have compassion for you. He wanted to get it right the first time so you didn't have to come back again and again. So there is that. There are parts of this bill that were concessions for miners. There were parts of it that were in there. His main concern was that he wanted to protect the fish species as well. So having this bill have worked through so many sessions, been poked and prodded through opposition, countless hours of agency reviews, and standing on the shoulders of legislation from work groups that started 4 years ago. After Senator Bates's passing, and once we knew that the bill was going to go, I continued to gather the agencies and LC and comb through the bill for language or implementation improvements. That was the version that was dropped on the 21st. I worked with the best of my intention to fulfill Senator Bates's values and wishes, and proceed as he would. I would like to speak to the true intention of Senator Bates's wishes for this bill. He was a thoughtful man who got joy in his life from serving others, and that was not limited to just those of us who are here right now, but those who would be born even after he died. Senator Bates knew that we have a responsibility because the next generation will have to live with our choices. He understood value and importance of a legacy and that our actions would be leaving one whether we did it consciously or unconsciously. His intentions with Senate Bills 3 were to protect and preserve the fish, the rivers, the tribal heritage, the economy, and quality of life for those who live and take refuge on the rivers like he did, to ensure that for generations to come, Oregonians would have rivers preserved the way they were for us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julie. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate your willingness to come and talk to us. I know how hard it is. You are embodying the way we all feel about Dr. Bates, and that we're still in shock, frankly, about his loss, but still in such deep admiration for everything that he did. And I think it's with that, in that spirit, that we're going to address this issue. For myself, that's what I promise. Colleagues, any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, both of you. Okay. Our next panel, we have a panel of representatives of the responsible agencies. So Karen Tarnow from DEQ, Ian Maiden from Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, DGAMI, Russ Stopp from Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Eric Metz from Department of State Lands. And Shelley, can we get a fourth chair up there? Yeah, thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Dumbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Tarnow with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here with my colleagues today to talk about Senate Bill 3 and what it would do, but also to talk first about some of the history that got us to where we are today. And in doing that, what I first want to do is very quickly cover what regulations are currently in place where mining's allowed without the moratorium. These were essentially things that would be happening if none of this legislation would, you know, had come before you. And then I want to talk about Senate Bill 838, which was in 2013, which was kind of what kicked things off. And then we'll talk about what's in Senate Bill 3. I'll talk about the parts of the bill that relate to the in-water suction dredge placer mining, and Ian Madden from DOGAMI will be talking about the parts that refer to the upland placer mining aspect. And Russ and Eric are here to help answer questions that, you know, might come up at any time. So first, just talk about the regulations that are in place wherever mining is allowed currently. Those who are in the in-water suction dredge mining, so those who are suction dredge mining in the state are required to get a wastewater discharge permit from DEQ. That's, as far as I know, everybody who has obtained a permit is able to be covered under our 700 PM general permit. And I'll give you some of the details on that in just a minute. Also, if a miner is operating in essential semi-arid habitat, they also need to get a general authorization from DSL. That authorization, it limits the amount of material they can move and the size of the dredges. And if anyone wants to do something above and beyond what's allowed in these general permits, they need to get an individual permit from DEQ and potentially DSL as well. So DEQ's 700 PM general permit, it includes a number of restrictions or conditions. One is it restricts the amount of turbidity that they can create from their operation. If they're creating too much turbidity, they pretty much need to move to where there's less fine sediment. If they encounter fish eggs, mussels, or lamprey, they need to move and operate someplace where those organisms aren't found. There's a few different kinds of conditions to ensure that banks aren't undercut or cut into, and other measures to ensure that there's not any significant damage to channel structure. There's prevention measures for oil and gas spills. They're required to decontaminate their dredge when moving it from one water body to another. They're limited to operating within the in-water work periods that ODF&W sets up. And since 2015, when we reissued that 700 PM permit, they're required to provide us with the specific locations where they'll be mining. That's a lat long position. And they're also required to display their permit number on the dredge.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you. These regulations now, are they in place from the last legislation we passed, 838?
The 700 PM permit has been in place for a number of years. It's renewed every 5 years, and so the last renewal was in 2015.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Did DEQ, prior to all of this activity, did DEQ think that those regulations were appropriate to protect the streams?
Chair Dembro and Senator Olson, this permit is protective of water quality in the streams. Yes, we are authorizing such and dredge activity in a manner that will be consistent with the Federal Clean Water Act. This is a federal permit.
So to follow up on that, you are saying that DEQ thought that these regulations, as they are contained in, would protect the streams, and you weren't worried about them?
Chair Dembro and Senator Olson, from a water quality perspective, yes.
Thank you.
There are also restrictions in place in through other state law that suction dredge mining is not allowed in state scenic waterways. And on tribal reservations, it's not that it's prohibited, but DEQ cannot issue a permit for those areas. Either the tribe or EPA must issue those permits. Another provision is not technically a prohibition, but effectively we believe it is. On waters that are not meeting water quality standards for sedimentation, turbidity, or toxics, a miner cannot obtain our general permit to operate. They must obtain an individual permit. And we, in short, don't think that an individual permit is either technically or it's either cost prohibitive or maybe even infeasible for a miner to operate suction dredge in a way that could meet permit limits that we would have to include to have a lawfully adequate permit. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
It's me again. Thank you. Yeah. I hate to interrupt you, but as you're there, it seems like a good place to ask a question. How many waters do you know how many miles of river were impaired or how many waters were impaired? Because we have a huge list of rivers and waters. And I just wondered if you had an approximation of what, if it was 10%. Oh, you have it.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Bingo.
So these are the waters that are listed for any one of those parameters, not meeting those water quality standards for those parameters. It represents about 5% of the river miles in the state.
Thank you very much.
So that was the regulations in place governing suction dredge mining in water. Now to switch to the upland piece, and the in-water is regulated by DEQ and DSL. The upland mining is regulated by DEQ and sometimes DOGAMI. Most of the folks that are the miners in the population that we're talking about right now are operating under a DEQ water pollution control facility permit. This is a state permit that it's really aimed at ensuring that their mining activity and use of the sedimentation pond is not allowing any discharge into the river, either over land or subsurface through interties between any of the ponds that they're using nearby the rivers. And it also directs the miner to avoid disturbance of any riparian vegetation, and if you do disturb it, to restore it. I'll just make a comment that there is no we have no reclamation authority or bonding or anything like that that goes along with the DOGAMI permit. This permit is currently free, and it's pretty simple and easy to obtain.
Karen, can I ask a question about that? So disturbing of vegetation, so are we talking about grass and shrubs or trees or all of the above that are being disturbed in this?
Chair Dembro, I believe it's just vegetation with a focus on riparian, so the vegetation near the streams. It's not very well defined in the permit.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Karen, who enforces your regulations? Do you guys send people out to the field to check?
Yeah. Chair Dembro and Senator Olson, typically we don't often send people out to enforce. Generally, we're only responding on a complaint basis. If somebody calls in and identifies some suspect activity, We generally refer to the state police. They are trained in what our regulations require, and if they're able to, they will go out and take a look at it. It can be difficult because, you know, if somebody sees something, they call it in, it might be a day or more until, if the police can get out there, and if they don't observe activity, then they can't do anything about it. So there's...
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, so my question is about where do we do placer mining now? Is it only along riverbeds? Is it out in places where there used to be riverbeds? Where do we do placer mining in Oregon, not in the river?
Sure. Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I might ask for some help from my colleagues here on that one.
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, members of the committee.
Ian, could you identify yourself?
Excuse me?
Could you identify yourself?
Certainly. My name is Ian Maiden. I'm Chief Scientist and Deputy Director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. The majority of placer deposits in the state are generally adjacent to or in the valleys of modern streams because they're deposited by the same processes. There are, however, places where those deposits are now hundreds of feet above the stream that deposited them, or the stream is long gone. But I'd say, you know, 80% of the placer material is in the valley adjacent to the stream that deposited it.
Okay. So there isn't a follow-up? Yes. There isn't an amount. In the bill, we're talking about 100 yards. There could be them outside 100 yards and other places, or?
That's absolutely correct. For instance, along the in the Galice area along the Rogue River, a lot of the mining was done from old river terraces that are hundreds of yards away from and 50 or 100 feet above the modern river.
But basically what we're talking about here is current riparian areas, right? Is that where that 100-yard
that's
limit?
Can I clarify? In this bill, that's what we're looking at?
Right.
In this regulation, it regulates all of those places. Is that not true? Not necessarily whether they're close to the river or not. If you're going to do placer mining in Oregon right now, these are the regulations that are in place, correct?
Yes.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yes, that's correct, Senator Olson.
Okay, back to Senator Olson.
This goes back to your discussion on the permits, et cetera, and I asked the question on who enforces it. Do you have a number of violations that happen per year, or was it an extraordinary amount, or do you happen to know what that is?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, I don't know it offhand. We did look into some of the that information a couple sessions ago, I think, so I could see what I could dig up. Generally speaking, in recent years, as long as I've been involved, we don't have a lot of reporting coming in, a lot of complaints coming in, or very few actions that have been carried through enforcement. A lot of these, as I understand it, a lot of these activities are in areas where, you know, people aren't necessarily around to keep an eye on things. So I guess the last sentence here is depending on the size, if they're over 5,000 cubic yards of material that they're moving, then they'll also require need to get a dogami permit, and Ian will talk more about that. What that looks like a little bit later on. So that was what was existing, and now I'm going to go back to 2013 and talk about Senate Bill 838 that did two things, the moratorium and a task force. So mostly, I'm generalizing a little bit here. So Senate Bill 838 required the governor to, in consultation with state and federal agencies and tribes and other stakeholders, to propose a revised regulatory framework. And it identified specifically all these things that framework needed to contain. Won't read them all out loud. That report was due to be delivered by November 2014 in advance of the 2015 session. The bill also, Senate Bill 838, also contained a five-year moratorium that would kick in 2016. The thinking being, if there was a revised regulatory framework that could be approved in 2015, perhaps the moratorium would go away and the revised framework would go forward. That did not occur. So in 2016, the five-year moratorium began. It applies in the rivers, in essential semiotic habitat and bull trout spawning habitat, except where populations are not found due to a natural or lawfully placed barrier. Basically, the way we're interpreting that is that if a fish isn't going upstream, it's either because there's a dam there or there's some natural condition that makes upstream uninhabitable. So what this translates to is we're looking at what are the areas that ODFW has mapped as being ESH or bull trout habitat, and that represents about 15 to 30% of the waters in the state, depending on what kinds of base layer maps that you're using. The moratorium also applies 100 yards upland from ordinary high water mark if the placer mining, motorized placer mining activity will disturb vegetation in a manner that may impact water quality. This is not a prohibition. It may be a prohibition in some areas where you can't mine if you can't impact vegetation. It's also something that it's very hard to enforce if we had to, you know, to identify what disturbing vegetation in a manner that will impact water quality actually looks like. The moratorium does not apply if an operation is covered by a DOGAMI permit.
Yes, Senator Rupple.
So this one, in the moratorium, we're talking about the river, not the tributaries to that river above that spawning habitat.
I'm sorry, we're talking about the river?
The river as opposed to the tributaries that are above that spawning habitat. Is that correct?
Correct. Chair Dembro.
The moratorium only deals with the river itself, not tributaries of that river above that extent.
Yeah, Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, it addresses the identified habitat, you know, the distribution of the fish where they're known to be, not waters feeding into those specific areas, so not the tributaries, correct.
But it does talk about that those waters above the lowest extent of spawning habitat. So, I mean, the reason that we have habitat is limited has to do with a dam is one issue. Mm-hmm. Another issue is altitude, because certain spawners are not going to go to a certain altitude. So there could be a number of reasons, one of which is place of deposits, because you've got to have a place to lay your eggs. So
correct.
There's a lot of reasons above that it might not be spawning habitat. So, but in this one, it just says rivers, not tributaries to those rivers.
Correct.
Okay.
So, Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, when we put a map together to represent this area, we looked at what's the lowest spawning habitat in the river and what's the most upstream habitat. And connected those dots.
Gotcha.
And that's true if it's the named river or a tributary to that named river. That is, if it's a tributary, but there's still essential salmonid habitat, it's covered. Is that correct?
That's, Chair Dembro, that's correct. Yes, that's correct. It'd be nice to have a board to draw this out on.
It is correct.
Russ, yeah, identify yourself, please.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stoff. I'm the Rogue Watershed Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. My office is in Central Point. The way that we designated the distribution of fish in ESH in the current moratorium, Senator Roblin, is the actual distribution of fish that we know. So we know that if you want to identify the upstream reach of fish, their distribution generally reflects that, and you can't find a waterfall or something to designate that. ESH contains both spawning and rearing habitat, but not migratory corridors. So when we look at ESH as the identified habitat, we go all the way up of the main stem until we run out of rearing habitat and spawning habitat, and then any tributary that has ESH in it. It also included bull trout in the moratorium, of course.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
And this is a picture of the current moratorium. It covers, as I mentioned, 15 to 30% of the waters in the state. The red dots you're going to see on the rest of the maps that I show here, they're presented, what those represent are the locations that were identified by suction dredge miners in their 2015 permit applications. We had, there were a total of 894 locations identified, And we're putting them on the map to give you an idea of where the mining activity typically occurs. It is not comprehensive, but it's representative, because people have said, you know, the moratorium doesn't really matter unless it's in the area where people want to mine. And so that's why we're including it here, to put some reference point on that.
And that is that in water? Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Is that in water suction dredge mining we're talking about for those dots?
Correct, Senator Denbro, Senator Roblin. That's in water. We do not currently have good information on the location of the upland mining activities.
Thanks.
Okay, so now we're up to Senate Bill 3. And that does a couple of things. It changes the moratorium, and it also talks about the future regulatory framework post-moratorium. So the changes to the moratorium are that it adds lamprey habitat, and it also includes all the tributaries feeding into any of the moratorium waters. This is clearly, it expands the moratorium significantly. The lamprey habitat probably doesn't make a difference. It's probably already covered by ESH, but including the tributaries that flow into moratorium waters expands the moratorium to about 80 to 90% of those waters. There are a couple little glitches with the map, so this is not going to be the map going forward, but it's the best that we have right now, and it's good representation.
So, Karen, can we go back and you know, again, drilling down on the definition of tributaries? Are these tributaries where there is, you know, where fish are spawning or rearing?
Chair Denbro, so what we were talking about before is actual identified habitat and connecting the dots between. This it looks at the moratorium waters, and then it traces all the streams upstream. It is whether or not the habitat exists there. If the water is flowing into an area where there's moratorium area identified, it would be included in the moratorium.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh. Yes, and
thank
then
you.
I have a question. Okay. Go ahead,
Senator. So we've gone essentially from 15 to 30% of the state to 80 to 90% of the state.
That's correct.
So we've basically tripled what we've put off limits. Okay, thank you.
That's correct.
Karen, remind me of the decision to not include lamprey in the moratorium and then to now it's being included. Lamprey had always been intended to be part of this program, wasn't it? I mean, it was mentioned in Senate Bill 838, and the task force definitely discussed it along with, I think, freshwater mollusks.
Correct. Chair Denbro, so in the post-moratorium regulatory framework, lamprey are included in the protected waters. I honestly don't know why they were included in the moratorium.
Chair Denbro.
Thanks, Russ.
It was my impression that they were not included in the original description, Senate Bill 838, of the moratorium. And the moratorium was intended in case the 2015 session didn't enact legislation. My impression was that it just wasn't intended to be all that encompassing. There was an expectation that we would resolve this in 2015.
Actually, I think there was also something about the salmon and the bull trout were listed species, whereas the lamprey was not at the time a listed species?
It's correct that lamprey are not listed. I don't recall if that was an element of the bill or not, but ESH includes any anadromous salmonid that's on a state or federal list. So it's really a broad grouping of listings for essential salmonid habitat. But I think we were unaware as to why lamprey were not included in the original one.
Sure.
Yes.
Russ, you might correct me on this, but I think in the original bill, one of the essential components of dredge mining was that they couldn't be on the water when there was any salmonoid presence, or they were there August and September before the runs, and it didn't, from my opinion, because I've been on this through the whole time, from my opinion, it didn't quite fit the criteria, so we added lamprey, because lamprey are always there. I know they don't spawn there all the time, but they're in stream most of the time.
That may very well be correct, Vice Chair Olson. The lamprey have a life history that they're present in stream. Their larval stage is present for up to 8 years. So unlike salmon and steelhead, there isn't a period in the summer or sometime when there aren't juveniles embedded in the substrate, which is what occurs with lamprey. The actual larval are embedded in the substrate year-round with that. So that's a valid point.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Yeah. He's on the other side, but I'll take it anyway. Yeah, he is a handsome dog.
Senator, I'm so used to calling on Senator Olson. I'm sorry. Senator Roblin, sorry.
Yeah, and I think there was a much broader conversation since this has been going about lamprey in particular. Our tribes have brought in the issue with respect to lamprey, a better recognition of their life history, which we truly don't have a lot of information on. And I think the recognition of what you're saying, that they're there for up to 8 years, and we have seen a big decline in lamprey over the last number of years, and we don't know where that cycle is coming from. So given all those reasons, I think it was in the best interest of everybody to have a conversation about lamprey, and I think that's one of the reasons it got added. That's just my personal, from outside watching what was going on.
Thank you.
Okay, so Senate Bill 3, much like Senate Bill 1530 in 2016 and Senate Bill 830 in 2015, defines what the regulatory framework would be like after the moratorium starting in 2021. For the suction dredge mining, what it establishes is that the DEQ and DSL permitting would be consolidated in DEQ. DEQ would be under an MOA with DSL issuing both removal fill and water quality permits in a consolidated permit. There would be an application review process where when somebody applies for a suction dredge permit, there'd be an opportunity for other state and federal agencies and tribes to review the application and identify any concerns or conditions they feel are necessary. It also includes authority for the state police to write citation. I actually didn't mention that when I was talking about the moratorium. The other change to the moratorium law is that it adds the ability for state police to write citations for violations of the moratorium. Same thing, it does the same thing for the post-moratorium regulatory framework. The Senate bill also requires that suction dredges stop at the invasive species check stops that ODFW has around the state.
So does,
yes, Senator Roblin.
Fish and wildlife officers who are out, who act as state police at time, would they also be included in that ability to write a ticket? Do you know? Our fish and wildlife officers who give tickets for wildlife violations, would they be able to write tickets?
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, that is correct. One of the biggest frustrations for ODFW and Oregon State Police over the years is their inability. The statutes for DSL and DEQ don't allow officers to do anything except cite as misdemeanors through the district attorney's office. Okay. And so this will fix that. That's a very good fix.
Other details about the future regulation of suction dredge mining. The bill identifies a number of conditions that are already in effect right now under our 700 PM permit. What I've summarized here are the additional provisions, what's layered on top of what already exists. It prohibits suction dredge mining in biological resource habitat, which is identified as the habitat essential for the conservation and restoration of these species.
And Karen, mm-hmm. Can I just interrupt you there? You know, the use of that term biological resource or specified biological resource, mm-hmm. is that just a shorthand so that you don't have to keep listing each of those species?
Chair Dembro, yes, I think so.
It has no life on its own, right?
It's a new term, newly defined in the bill. The bill would also prohibit suction dredge mining in state parks, on tribal lands, and federal wilderness areas, and a couple of other federal designated types of conservation areas. It prohibits suction dredge mining in the impaired waters I've been talking about, although those are all effectively pretty much prohibited anyway currently. And the protected areas are estimated to amount to about 30 to 40% of the waters, and I'll show you a map of that in just a moment. The bill also requires DSL to go through a rulemaking to develop a permit that's going to then be part of DEQ's consolidated permit to establish these prohibitions, but also to address a number of other issues about social conflicts, noise, and noise and perhaps navigation, such distance between operations, and cultural resource protection.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Yes, she had on there on your list was freshwater mollusks. Russ, how many of our waters have freshwater mollusks in them?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, we don't understand the distribution of freshwater mollusks all that well. And in the context of the legislation here, or the intent of Senate Bill 838, it's really freshwater mussels, which are a subset of mollusks, which would include snails and slugs and the such. They're poorly understood. They're probably historically were present in most waters. We can find them in most waters now.
Yes.
So we have 110,000 miles of riverway. So you would say that out of that 110,000, it's in mollusks or in most of it?
Somewhere within the watershed. So if we were talking about, you know, the main stem Deschutes or the main stem Rogue, you know, somewhere within it you can find some, but they're not that abundant. And I really couldn't speak to it beyond that. They have life histories that are generally dependent upon salmon and steelhead or trout, and that they have a larval stage that's parasitic, so they can get transported further back upstream, because they would, as a sessile animal that broadcasts spawn, they only go downstream. And so the way that they don't all end up in the bay is by attaching to a fish and going further upstream. So generally speaking, most species are limited to the distribution of salmon and steelhead and trout.
That's a follow-up. How would you then, as the ODFW, be able to tell a placer miner an area that would be, they would be allowed to you know, placer mine in, or couldn't because of the mollusks? Would you have to go out and physically examine?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, that question, of course, came up with the work group with the governor's office. So I brought in members of the Xerces Society, or we did, the work group brought in members of the Xerces Society, which do invertebrates, and there's some members of that group that are very interested in freshwater mussels. They're really the scientists that know the most and do the most work on them. Their recommendation to us was that since we don't have distribution data like we do for salmon or steelhead or other species, that we would just now use best management practices as an element of a permit condition in the future to say, if you encounter them, here's the things that you do. And then down the road, when we get distribution data, we might be able to overlay an actual distribution.
That's very useful.
Thank you. And I should mention this map does not include any explicitly mapped mussel distribution, because ODFW doesn't really have any. So what it represents is, as Russ was talking about, is the fish distribution, the fish of, you know, of which their life history is associated with. So I'm going to turn it over now to Ian to talk about what Senate Bill 3 does for the
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'm going to walk through real quickly the changes in permitting requirements for mines that are the result of Senate Bill 3. So I was going to start with this little summary here. We divide the world of mining into two classes, big mines and small mines. And the dividing line between those two is 5,000 cubic yards of excavation per year, or more than 1 acre of disturbance per year, or more than a total of 5 acres of disturbance. So if you're above that, currently, you need an operating permit. Senate Bill 3 doesn't change that for large mines. If you're below that, currently you need an exclusion certificate. Senate Bill 3 breaks the population of small mines into two. It creates a new class, nominally called upland placer miners, that will now be required to get an operating permit, like a large mine. And the exclusion certificate is restricted to aggregate mines only. So the definition of the upland placer mines is all mines using or precious metal placer mines using motorized equipment for site preparation or excavation with greater than 6 horsepower that are located within 100 yards of the ordinary high water line of a stream in Oregon. And the map that you see here is nominally the area that is covered by that that definition. So it's the majority of the streams in the state. An operating permit is a fairly substantial undertaking. The minimum costs are between $10,000 and $15,000. This includes our permit fee, which is $1,750. It includes a site survey map done by a registered surveyor that is a statutory requirement, cannot be waived. Those cost a minimum of $3,000. It requires security to ensure reclamation. Most small miners are unable to get bonds, which is what larger commercial operations would have. So in this case, they're required to either put up cash or a certificate of deposit kind of arrangement. So that gets us the majority of the way to that $10,000. And then to get an operating permit from us, you need to have land use approval from the local jurisdiction. And the costs for obtaining that vary widely, but they're rarely less than a few hundred dollars. There's also a variety of other aspects of the permit that can be required depending on the site. We circulate these permit applications to a wide range of agencies, including tribal governments, for comments on their perspective on the impacts of the mining to local resources. And those comments often result in the requirements for further studies, for instance, for wetlands or cultural resources. These sites are what we would call floodplain sites because they involve the floodplain areas of the streams. Those typically are the most complicated permitting sites that we have for our large mines. The exclusion certificate is an $80 application fee. It's a one-page form, $150 annual renewal fee, and the only requirement is annual renewal and a report of the amount of material that you produce. It has no other requirements, and it does not require reclamation.
Okay, Ian, just a sec. Senator Olson.
Another question. When you have the site surveyed, how does DAGAMI protect? Is that public information so everyone can know where this mining site is? Or how does the miner protect his claim?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, it is a public record.
Okay, thank you.
However, I would point out that if they have a claim to the federal government, that's also a public record. Okay. So if they're operating on an actual mining claim, that's a public record.
Thank you.
So the enforcement options that we have for the large mines with operating permits, we go through a sort of a variety of steps, a notice of violation if there's concerns, if they're violating permit conditions or if they haven't renewed. We can go to a suspension order. And then the big stick is the notice of intent to recover security. So basically we say, we are going to call your bond and use that money to reclaim your site and close it. And that generally gets people's compliance. We also have the ability to levy criminal penalties and civil penalties. As far as I can tell, we haven't done that in decades and have no experience with how to do it. So the really important thing here is security is our leverage when we're working with large mines. For the small mines, under the current regulations, we have essentially only the notice of violation suspension order, but those don't mean anything to somebody that doesn't have a permit with us. And again, the criminal penalties or civil penalties, which we don't ever employ. SB 3 adds a couple of tools there. It gives us the opportunity for a Class A violation for someone who's operating without the required permit. And so that would give us a way to at least get started with the process. But again, it's a very different thing when we're going out and trying to encourage a population of people to sign up for this permit when we have limited leverage.
Question.
And so finally, this is just sort of a summary of the changes. We're going from relatively simple exclusion certificates required currently for these small mines to much more complicated and expensive operating permit requirements.
Okay, and Ian, if you could just hold a minute. Senator Roebling.
So if there is the ability to do in-water, they would stay small scale. They'd be pretty much doing the same thing we do now. If it's up on the bank, even the small ones would go to a new permitting permission.
Chair
do we have any information at all, and I don't know that we've ever collected this, on how much money these small scale upland people have ever made in a claim? I mean, I'm trying to believe that $10,000 to $15,000 on a one-acre requirement, I don't know that they're going to make the thousands of dollars in any one of those. So by having a permit process of this kind, we may be excluding them because of economics rather than excluding them because of other reasons. I just, if there's any information about that, I'd love to know it.
Okay. Chair Denbrough, Senator Roblin, we have no information as to how much gold is produced by this kind of mining and no way to collect it.
Okay.
That's basically what I had to cover.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Dagami here? Okay, colleagues, let me just open things up in general for, we have these agency experts here in front of us. Any questions that you might have for them? Let's start with Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you extending an opportunity for me to sit here and ask a question. You only lost me in one spot, and thank you, Karen, because we've been at this 4 years now, 5 years, something like that, okay? And most of us here have been here the whole thing. But you sort of lost me on the maps, because we started out with the moratorium map on your screen there. It's roughly 30%, and then we went to a 80 to 90% map, and then we went back to a
30 to 40
midstream map. Okay, so explain the difference of the three maps here, because I'm a visual person trying to understand. Are we apples and oranges? One applies just to one, and one applies to the other.
We'll see how I can do this time.
Here's the moratorium, which we're all familiar with for quite a while.
Right. So, Chair Denbrough and Senator Boquist, current moratorium is by and large, it's ESH and bull trout habitat.
So, but it does have upland parts of that, right?
Yes. Yes, if there's a prohibition against being within 100 yards and disturbing vegetation in a way that will affect water
quality. In those same places.
Right. And, yeah, limited to
those
beside moratorium waters, correct.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The expanded moratorium traces everything upstream from those moratorium waters, up tribs, up to headwaters.
And includes the 100 yards.
That's a good clarification, Senator Roblin. So it does include the 100 yards up until 2019. In 2019, let me make sure I got this right. In 2019, the upland operations are removed from the moratorium, and they have the new permitting regime. So, right, for the initial period for Dogami to get their new permit together, this expansion of the upland moratorium, it would apply to the upland miners.
Karen, is that when the $10,000 fee starts in 2019?
Chair, Senator Olson, no.
Yeah, okay. Only more than later.
It's only if three passes.
That's scary. That is scary.
Okay. Right. Correct.
So the higher fee for the for the smaller upland claims, because that would go into effect with the when this bill goes into effect?
So Chair Denbrough, as I understand it, the expanded moratorium would go into effect upon the bill's effective date. So presumably, this summer. In 2019, the upland folks are removed from the moratorium and have to go to Dogami for their permits, and that's where the cost kicks in.
Okay.
Sound right? Okay.
Clarification, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. So then the third map is the 2019 map.
That's correct, Chair Denbrough, Senator Boquist. This is post-moratorium what we're looking at. So it's a lot like the existing moratorium, adding lamprey, there's some errors with the map, so it's sort of generic right now. But it adds lamprey, and the other thing that it adds are these other state parks federal wilderness areas, a number of sort of designated areas that are where suction dredge mining will also be prohibited. So this is just the suction dredge mining future beginning in 2021.
And those areas that were covered, the 100 yards that was in those areas, the 100 yards that was out expanded would go into the new permit system. So would all the permitting for any of the smaller uplands would go into the permit system in here, right? Okay, so every place that, and then in fact, there's even more places with the other map, right? Okay, that's what I want. There's one more map.
We're missing a map.
The Dogami map. Could you go to the Dogami map?
Yeah.
That's the entire state.
But that's just the permitting stuff going into effect.
And that's the entire state, correct?
Chair Dembo, Vice Chair Olson, it's 30% of the area of the state and essentially all streams in the state.
And follow, and that would be covered by the higher permit cost?
That would be covered by the requirement to get an operating permit.
Senator Dembro, Senator Olson, the bill bifurcates the in-water and the upland beginning in 2019. So, yeah, very different pathways depending on what kind of mining you're doing.
But essentially, if Senate Bill 3 passes, due to the cost ramifications for miners, you've banned all mining in the state unless someone can come up with 30 or 40, 20, 15, $25,000, $30,000 to open up a mine. Is that correct or not?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, it's correct that all of those places or those operators will be required to get a permit, and it is certainly true that many of them will have a very difficult time meeting those financial requirements. I would point out that there are 900-some operations in the state that do have operating permits with these requirements, so it's not impossible to get it, but it does require significant revenue.
Follow up to that, then, are they placer miners looking for gold, or are they gravel pits that you're referring to, or larger operations, Knife River, stuff like that?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, the majority of those are aggregate operations. There's probably a couple dozen placer operations. They tend to be larger and more productive.
All right, thank you.
Yes, Senator Roble.
So my understanding is that this does not affect a person. Well, I'm not sure if my understanding is there. So there are a group of weekend placer miner people all over the South Coast, and they take a pick and a shovel, and they go out and they look for their stuff in those same places. Would they need a permit to do that?
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, the deciding factor on that would be whether they're within 100 yards of the ordinary high water line and whether they're using motorized equipment with greater than 6 horsepower to do their site preparation or excavation.
So no, if you're not using any motorized equipment,
you would not need a permit. However, there is no, if you are using motorized equipment, there is no lower bound on the amount of area that you disturb or the amount of material that you move.
Right.
Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be for Russ. So my overall feeling on all this mining stuff is, you know, we're trying to protect our fisheries. I think there's some other objectives, but I think that's the overall. If my perception is right, Rose, my question to you is, salmon's probably the number one we're trying to protect. Is that a good?
Chair Dembro, Senator Bearsugar, I think that's the highest priority in a lot of places, yes.
Yes.
If that's our objective here, shouldn't we actually move that discussion to the oceans? Isn't that the biggest unknown that we are seeing now? Since we've put a lot of time and money studying salmon in the river system, but isn't the ocean now starting to be the big question?
Chair Dembro, Senator Bearsugar, the ocean is generally the largest limiting factor for most of our anadromous populations that go to the ocean.
Sure.
So the other question I have is, isn't there also a point where we could actually have too many salmon in the river at one time?
Senator Chair Dembro, Senator Bearsugar, I think that would be a matter of opinion. In the context of historical numbers of salmon, Chinook, coho, et cetera, no, we would not think that would be the case. They tended to bring nutrients back upstream. We probably overall, on average, had much higher abundances 300-400 years ago than we see, you know, post-development.
I think there are people in this room that could take care of that problem, Senator, and would love to. Yes, Senator Roble.
So, following in that line, if our main purpose of Senate Bill 3 is to protect indigenous species, in particular those that go out to sea, anadromous ones, so lamprey, salmon, coho, and otherwise, and those, this map is protecting a whole lot more than those. I mean, if you go back to your first couple maps, they protected all those. So what are we protecting here in Senate Bill 3 that was not protected in those earlier maps that is important? What's the value of adding all of this other land to the bill? If our main issue is to protect salmon and these others, what's the underlying purpose for all of this protection that you guys see? Both natural, yeah, I'll go with Fish and Wildlife or DEQ.
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I think I first would like to point out that the bill as proposed and the moratorium as it exists protects resident fish and particularly bull trout, which are sensitive to this type of disturbance in their habitats. I think the way that we've gotten to the tributary situation where we're talking about all tributary waters upstream of the distribution was that the language about barriers, the lawfully placed and natural barriers to fish migration that's within the current moratorium is not in this bill, and so it expands it dramatically. My agency can't speak to the rationale for that.
Do we think that there were populations in all of that area at one time of our
the salmon and so on? Senator Roblin, no. The historic distribution is greater than it is now. You know, for example, the current moratorium is a lawfully placed barrier that would include the Snake River dams, and of course we had, you know, anadromous fish in Nevada through the Hawaii.
Sure.
Yes, and let's make this the last question.
Okay, well, that's fine. And it will be because I have to leave, as I told you. Russ, prior to the consummation of Senate Bill 838 and the discussions along placer mining, we had a tremendous influx of placer miners from California. Prior to that time, did we have any of this difficulty with placer miners interfering with bull trout or salmon habitat? Because you guys pretty well directed when they could do it, how they could do it, and why they could do it. But it was the influx of the California miners that really caused a problem for our Oregon miners. So my question again is, before that time, was there any consideration to eliminating placer miners because of what they allegedly have done to the stream beds?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, we took a look along with the permitting agencies at that time at 2010 and 2011-12. While we had an influx of miners from California, we also had many of those miners were not from California. They were resident. Post-recession, we saw gold prices spike. And to answer your question, in the past, we have seen activity in this endeavor go up and down dramatically depending upon the price of gold. Of course, I think the committee members are aware of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's testimony on Senate Bill 838, which was we thought that this fish can withstand the occasional disturbance due to this activity, but it's really an issue of regulating it and having enforceable conditions, and that largely related to state police's inability to write citations.
Thank you.
Actually, I do have one other question, one last question. Sorry.
No, you're violating your own rules.
No, it's a
$10,000 fine right here.
Yeah. It's important that we get this out. Karen, do you have a sense of how many the moratorium is in effect now, and it went into effect a year ago, right? And so do you have numbers for how many permits were issued last year, I mean, during the moratorium?
Yes, Chair Dembro. So in 2015, which was before the moratorium, we had 351 people. Well, I should say, let's go back to 2013, which was before the moratorium and before other requirements of Senate Bill 838 kicked in, which included a $150 surcharge and some limits on some other limits, but a $150 surcharge was significant. So in 2013, we had 1,800 people under our $25 suction dredge permit. And 2014, when the surcharge kicked in, it dropped down to 536. In 2015, it was 351. And then in 2016, when the moratorium kicked in, it was 156.
Thank you. Thank you all for really a clear presentation. Yes.
It's been brought to my attention that there's been some people here to testify that have traveled some great distance, and they plan on traveling home again.
Yes.
So. Yes,
and I think we'll start hearing from some of those. We have two panels, and then we will open it up to people in sign-up order or as close to sign-up order as possible. So the second panel, we have Louis Pitt, Charles Gehrer, and Jack Williams, please, if you could come up. And then after them, we'll have Rich Angstrom, Larry Chase, and Mike Hunter. Welcome. Louis, do you want to start
sure.
it off?
Sure.
It's great to have you.
Jan Schwicht, Louis Pitt, Jr., I'm a Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and thank you, committee, for the opportunity. I appreciate your efforts for a lot of reasons. One of them is, of course, helping our way of life through protecting the wonderful bounties that Oregon as a state provides and the gifts from the Creator that's been provided for us since time immemorial. The Warm Springs Tribes is a treaty tribe, and we have fought for our way of life using all the tools that we have, and treaty is one of them. That is a treaty that was cut with the U.S., United States of America, and the laws passed down to the state of Oregon here. And we're not only talking about, as the bill says, about lands that we exclusively own. We have rights off reservation, too, so please keep that in mind. Later on, we will have more concise reports. We gave to the United States 10 million acres of lands, title of those lands, of which you have 13 counties. And I have to remind some of my neighbors, like all the 100% of Jefferson County, Hood River, Wasco County, Gilliam, all of those were owned by the Confederated Tribes, the Wasco and the Warm Springs. So when we cut the deal with the USA, we our elders in wisdom saw so important our way of life that we lived on the land that we reserved. Nobody gave us the right to fish. Nobody gave us the right to hunt. We reserved that as equals with the United States. Please keep that in mind. Reserved. Nobody gave us that. And my job has been for years, I'm an old fish head, we call them, as I worked in natural resources for years. Chair Dembrow, you asked about freshwater mussels. Yes, we do have those. And I was having fun after a four-mile walk down a pristine stream called Beaver Creek and was just relaxing there. And I did see, I thought it was a clam. And later on, through our biologist, found out it was a freshwater mussel. And they are used for adornments for some of our folks. And some of the elders said, yes, they pretty much have died off because of a lot of management activity. But in pristine waters, I can verify that. I have walked. One walk was like 11 miles long back in my younger days, of course. Couldn't do that now. That you have the freshwater mussels that are great indicators for really clean streams. And they're a lot of fun to play with. They close up when you touch them. And so I had, after a long walk, it's a lot of fun. Lampreys, another one, is assume is what the Warm Springers call that, is a food. And again, as Senator Roblin has said, yes, we're just starting to learn about what they are, who they are. Culturally, I can say they're very important to the tribes of, at least the Warm Springs tribes. I can speak for us, and they are a medicine of sorts, and anyway, it's very important to us. I appreciate the moratorium, because we're always looking for ways. It's an institutional, broad resolution type of approach using the permitting systems of Oregon of protecting our way of life in our ceded lands and even off reservation. We also have other rights outside of the lands that we gave to the United States called usual and accustomed rights. And we use those in concert with the ODF&W. We just had a court case here, in a culvert court case in the state of Washington, that recognized our right to the environment in the state of Washington. They had a case that was brought, 11 years ago or so, about Indians got mad up there and says, hey, you know, we believe we have a right to protect the environment through adequately designed and properly built culverts. And it took a while, but a federal judge up there agreed. So what that means, I'm not sure. We have, again, I think through Senate Bill 770, executive order started by, can I say his name?
Sure.
Governor Kitzhaber. And a grand idea that I think the tribes pushed for, and he received and gave it life. And Senate Bill 770 has carried that on. So we're here to work with our partners. We're here. We know we can't do it alone. A treaty right and a big stick will make a lot of noise, but we don't get things done in solo. We have to work with the various land and water managers. And so I sure appreciate the I think the focus, the care and concern, how it fits, I'm not sure. I'm always struggling. I worked with the Lower Deschutes management plan, the John Day management plan, the Metolius River plan, a couple of wildernesses, try to advocate for our way of life and such, and we're always up against the recreationalists. And for us, it's not something as a hobby. It's a serious part of our way of life, is that lamprey, salmon, all of the rivers, what they provide are very important to our way of life. Cultural resources, I think there's a number of additions in here that I appreciate the committee putting those in here. And we will probably have to, I'll have to circle around back and talk to some of our technical folks about, okay, is that the big thing about anything that we do is how are we doing? So what are some of the measurements that I can be able to, if I stick around a few more years, is be able to judge how is this working? So that's one of the, what do they call that, a metric, mesuration, that type of stuff. So that's one of my jobs, is to try to help my elected leadership to figure out just how are we doing? Are we actually making life, quality of life, better in Oregon? Sure makes me feel good when we take a positive step like this, but we really need to have measuring tools. It's got an old principle right there that give us a grade on this at some point down the road, that how are we doing? So, again, committee. Chair, I hope I know you inquired about the freshwater mussels, and anyway, it's always been a pleasure to be walking out in the streams on reservation. Definitely, we have a lot of say bordering the reservation. There's treaty lessons you need to learn. We have something happening Thursday, and we'll have a information day in May. If you could find out more about the tribes, it sure be appreciated too. So again, I thank you for your record on this from the past. Is that I'm kind of a latecomer to this idea. I thought, yes, do something, got to do something, make it better, learn exactly how you can get a handle on this, and I think that's what you're doing. So thank you, committee.
Thank you very much, Director Pitt. So what I'm hearing from you is that you're supportive of the broad goals of this legislation. The details, as they evolve, you want to be kept abreast, and we will promise to do that.
Chairman, I think that you got it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Jack?
Sure.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today.
My name is Jack Williams. I'm the senior scientist for Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited is a conservation group that works to conserve trout and salmon in their habitat. I'd like to address my brief remarks to the value of the headwater tributary streams for the conservation of trout and salmon, Pacific lamprey, and bull trout. Let me briefly, very briefly summarize the value of these headwater tributary streams and why they should be protected. And I should say, of course, that we strongly support SB3. First, tributary streams are the primary connection between the larger spawning areas and the terrestrial environment. So as such, they're the primary sources of sediments, gravels, nutrients, and large woody materials to these larger rivers and spawning areas. Second, the tributary streams are the primary sources of cold water to these downstream spawning and rearing habitats. Even very small intermittent streams can have very important cold water sources through their subsurface flows. Third, the tributary streams are the primary producers of food for trout and salmon bearing streams. One study that I referenced in my written testimony showed that about half of the food of the insects that are consumed in the downstream areas are produced in the headwater tributaries. And fourth, the tributary streams provide valuable ecosystem services such as sediment storage, pollution control, nutrient recycling, flood control, water storage, and groundwater recharge. Tributary streams have been found to store fine sediments for decades and prevent these fine sediments from choking downstream spawning areas. And headwater tributaries also possess and retain excess nutrients such as phosphorus and nitrogen. Finally, during high runoff years, many smaller tributary streams actually can provide some limited spawning areas. Coho salmon, for example, are noted for spawning in some very small streams and just in 4 or 5 inches of water. So headwater streams are important for their sheer quantity. They're the building blocks of all larger streams and rivers. But the condition of the tributary streams determines their ability to provide the services I've just described. So what does it all mean? It simply means that the state of our larger rivers is a reflection of the condition of the tributaries. If we desire high-quality salmon, lamprey, bull trout spawning and rearing habitat, we must also provide protection to these headwaters tributaries. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that.
Charles?
Chairman Denbrough, members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, for the record, my name is Charles Gear. I'm a booking agent for fly fishing trips throughout the United States and a resident of Southern Oregon. I also volunteer for organizations that seek to protect native fish and clean water in my local watersheds. I urge the committee to vote in favor of SB3. As an avid angler and riverboater, ensuring clean water, healthy runs of anadromous fish, and quality recreation experiences on our local rivers is of the utmost importance to me. As a booking agent for fly fishing trips throughout the Pacific Northwest, I have a vested business interest in clean rivers and healthy populations of fish as well. The outdoor recreation industry is a major economic force in our state. The Outdoor Industry Association has published that the outdoor recreation industry generates $12.8 billion in consumer spending, $4 billion in wages and salaries, and $955 million in state and local tax revenue in the state of Oregon alone. I encourage you to protect industries that pay for the cost of their impacts and don't extract non-renewable natural resources. The measures outlined in SB3 squarely address the worst of the impacts to salmon, bull trout, and other sensitive aquatic species and their habitat, provides the state more sufficient resources to better manage the regulatory program and houses permitting under a single state agency. On my home river, the Rogue, I witnessed the exponential growth in numbers and density of suction dredges after California instituted their moratorium, coinciding with the rise in gold prices. And it was a clear and poignant example of a nearly unregulated extractive industry at the time. It's critical to prohibit mining activity in sensitive species habitat and all streams with essential salmonid habitat. We've witnessed the steady decline of salmon populations throughout Oregon for far too long. The state of Oregon is investing millions of dollars in restoring salmon habitat, yet outside the moratorium allows individuals to damage that habitat within a fairly inexpensive mining permit. We generally pay more for a fishing license where we end up putting all wild fish back. We must prohibit mining and activity in areas where the state has invested more than $100,000 in to restore salmon habitat. It seems common sense to me to ensure that permit fees for suction dredging substantially cover the cost of an effective program administered by the DEQ to analyze, issue, and enforce these regulations. We're already aware of suction dredge mining's impact to water quality, which is why there are currently regulations in place pertaining to the length of their sediment plumes. And I support a prohibition of suction dredging in streams already listed as having impaired water quality, as well as the riparian areas, which are essential to maintaining cool water and filtering runoff. For all of these reasons, I strongly support passing SB 3, and I thank you all for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Charles. I just have a question for you. So, you know, we've heard mention of, you know, the increase in activity after the California ban went in. So what if we were just to try to return to the status quo ante, that is, back to where we were before the California spike happened? What would be the problem with that?
In my opinion, probably none. You know, suction dredging and small-scale mining has gone on and is just a part of life in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest as fishing and hunting and other outdoor activities. I just feel that with something as extractive and non-renewable, there's some common sense regulations that could be put in place.
Thank you. Colleagues? Yes, Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Charles, kind of, you know, that's my neck of the woods. That's where I live. I live on the road. In fact, sometimes the Rogue River's in my front yard, depends on the winter. Where have you, so I've been trying to pay attention of this since this has been up. Unfortunately, since I got this Senate job, I don't get as much time to get on the river as I used to.
You get paid. So,
but anyways, where are you seeing this increase in activity? What areas? I'm pretty familiar, so you can.
Sure. So, I mean, certainly, you know, immediately after the California moratorium went in place, you know, the majority of that was from, say, Tuvel Park in Medford down to Grants Pass.
So Middle Road.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
The Middle Road. So do you think that's because they took out the dam and all that sediment went by and they're trying to capitalize on all the sediment?
Oh, quite possibly.
Yeah. So that might have been kind of like a single event. Maybe that's kind of passed by. Or are you still seeing it? I don't know. I never get up that
way.
We've
cut it down, but it's the number of licenses.
I don't know that it can necessarily be teased out as that's the only reason they were there. I couldn't speak to it because I wasn't there mining. You know.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
I guess for clarification, when we have had this issue before this committee before, I remember testimony coming out saying because of the fact that people could not go into the California rivers, they migrated up on an influx, and that's one of the reasons we introduced so much of the legislation to regulate to keep that influx in check so it wouldn't overwhelm the system.
I guess my question, Mr. Chair, is are we still seeing it? In other words, I think, are we past that? Are we still seeing that dredging there around Tuvel and below there? And
well, certainly not during this moratorium period.
Right.
And you know, my concern is that if we don't have regulation and a permitting program in place, what happens after the end of this moratorium period? You know, and I will say, you know, outside of, you know, we were just talking about the main stem Rogue and below the old Gold Ray Dam, but that wouldn't explain the increase in the Illinois Valley and tributaries.
Thanks, Charles. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to ask the question. Gentlemen, in looking at kind of a follow-on to the numbers, I mean, there's 1,800 permits according to the state agencies issued in 2013, which is too many. We figured that one out, right? So we've got there's 838s in place here. In the 2014, 2015, 2016, I mean, does it look like it improved before we fully implemented the moratorium? Did it look like some of the permitting processes we put in? Because we had a cap of 800 at one point, and of course we never even got close to the cap of 800. Nope. And, you know, 351, around 350, looks about like the mid-stride of there, you know, in the last, prior to the 20 full moratorium, in the, like the year and year and a half, did it look like that there was it was a better situation? Did it look like that the individuals that were actually were seen that were that you might not agree with as minors were better behaving than some of those who came up from California? It's always fun to blame in California. and, you know, the bad actors were kind of disappearing, and it was really people that were more responsible.
I'd say in my experience and in my opinion, the bad actors were more likely to be in less visible areas. Mm-hmm.
Okay, one follow-up.
I was just talking numbers, because obviously we had 1,800 permits in 2013 and 351, so there was certainly less individuals out there. And of course, less of anything, whether it's hunters or fishers. I mean, you have your favorite fishing hole, you have your guide. You don't want him to know where it's at, by the way. But that's what I was trying to get at. Did it seem like there was an improvement across the board, though?
On the mainstem rogue, certainly. Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, all three of you, for coming and testifying. I'll call up our third panel, Rich Engstrom, Larry Chase, and Mike Hunter, please. And while they're coming up, audience, you should know this committee ends at 5, but I'm happy to stay to receive testimony, and my colleagues may be called elsewhere.
I have to go at 9.
but we'll keep at it ideally until we hear everyone. Richie, do you want to kick it off?
Kick it off.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for the Oregon Mining Association on this issue. I know many of you know that I also represent OCAPA, but I'm not on this issue, and so I'm wearing the Oregon Mining Association hat. I think that's important to be clear with this committee where I'm at on it. My background, I think, is important here because I spent a lot of time on Oregon rivers, but also by education. I'm a biologist and also a forest manager through OSU. And then, as some of you know, Senator Prozanski knows, I spent a lot of time in a DA's office working on environmental enforcement cases and covered everything from the environment to you name it. So I have a pretty rich background on this and many other issues. There's two things I want to really talk about. Before I kick it off, though, just as a real quick matter, I want to talk about the exclusion certificate provision in the bill that talks about commercial sand and gravel. I think there is a lot of confusion over what that section does after talking to Chair Dembro on it. That section very simply prevents folks that don't have or requires, the way it is now, requires folks that are not under the jurisdiction of Dogami. That means that they're under 5,000 cubic yards. They have to pay a fee to show Dogami they don't have jurisdiction. So we're asking people to pay a fee to demonstrate that they don't have jurisdiction, so the state agency doesn't have jurisdiction. Is that clear? By limiting it to sand and gravel and commercial aggregates, what we're trying to get to is what we thought in the industry as we talked to Dogami back in 2015 when they did their bill for the fee bill, was to try to capture some of the evasion in the aggregate industry that we thought people weren't fairly reporting. And to those folks within the aggregate industry that are fairly reporting, they did not like those folks that weren't fairly reporting. That's what that's all about. It's a good provision in the bill that fixes a longstanding issue. But there are two areas of concern or areas to talk about on this bill. The first one's kind of a policy considerations for you to consider as you think about the bill and the merits of the bill. And the other one, I think, is more important, me wearing my biology hat a little bit and talking about how we're handling scientific evidence on this committee on this particular issue. And I think it's very important that I have the opportunity to get to that and talk about What NOAA Fisheries is doing and what U.S. Fish and Wildlife are doing is they evaluate through the federal process, which we haven't even talked about yet, what they're doing to get these mine applications processed. But this bill is actually, as much as it seems complicated, it's really not as complicated if you break it down and you just think of it from an upland and then you think of it strictly from an in-water perspective. If you take the upland side, right now the moratorium just applies to essential salmonid habitat and bull trout, all right? So in 2019, you just add two things. You add lamprey eel, and you add tributaries to the breadth of its coverage. Starting in 2019, you get rid of tributaries, but you add waters of the state of Oregon. So that changes the jurisdiction boundary. I'm not sure by much, because tributaries is a broad definition, but all waters of the state then are impacted by the bill, and you're required to have that fairly robust DOGAMI permit. And I say that because I want to get right to that point. One of the things I saw as we've been talking about this is we aren't talking about the burden and the length of permitting that that most of these mine sites have to go through with the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service. It's significant and substantial. They all go through the National NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, went away for a few seconds. And if there's a listed fish involved, they have to get a biological opinion. Or in fact, if there's any listed species around, they have to get a biological opinion through the services. It's way more robust. It's not like we're just getting a DEQ permit for those small upland miners right now. We got that whole federal process to go through. The other thing I think that's important, and I want to stress this, is we're taking, most of these are under 1,500 cubic yards. They're microscopic guys. And they are using motorized equipment that's greater than 6 horse, because they're using tractors, to be frank, and very small excavators. But we're going to put them through the exact same process that the major aggregate and major miners have to go through. And in that process, you have to get even land use confirmation from the local governments. That's not even weighed in of now having to put all of these through the land use system and make sure the counties are okay with each one of these applications. It's a big lift that we're asking these very small miners to do. On the suction and dredge, it's almost as simple. You start out with essential salmonid habitat and bull trout, and you add tributaries and lampreys, much the same as the upland. But that stays in effect until 2021. And where I really, I probably disagree with the agency's interpretation. If you look, and does everybody have their bill in front of them? Just look at page 6, section 12. Their presentation was in those particular areas like biological resource habitat, water quality, state parks, all of those, that you could get an individual or a general permit. I think you can't, given the way this is written. If you read sub 1 and 12, it says, in order to protect important natural resources, in addition to the prohibitions against placer mining and scenic waterways under a statute, motorized in-stream placer mining may not be permitted to occur within the beds and banks of the waters of the state that are, and it lists all of those 7 out. They made it seem like you could get a permit, and I think that was their testimony. And I just wanted to clarify that I don't see much ambiguity and may not be permitted. That seems pretty clear. So those 7 areas actually function as a prohibition in the area. And I think as you think about changes, if you're going to try to match it up with the testimony that the agencies gave, there might be some maneuvering that needs to be, or some modification that needs to be there.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Prezant.
Rich, I know you've worked this issue very tightly. I guess what I would like is if you could provide us with your list of what you think is wrong with 3 or whatever else that may hang it up later. Mm-hmm. So we can have that. We can have it on the record. We can try to work through that and make certain we try to accommodate all of those issues. So if you could provide us that in writing, that would be great.
Chair Dembro and Senator Prezant, I'll certainly do that. But one thing I want to challenge the agencies on is the definition of fresh water mollusks. I had not really looked at that issue from a, and I don't know much about it to be, you know, straight with the committee. But I did happen to Google it and look on the website at lunch just because I wasn't able to grasp what freshwater mollusks were all about. And for sure, it covers clams and it covers slugs and it covers snails. And it's kind of a broad term that encompasses all of those, right? Well, on the snail side, think about being on the river. And the trick here is even though we talk about salmon and steelhead, you have to add, when ODFNW says trout, that expands the jurisdiction's coverage significantly. And in the last map that DEQ put up, it doesn't have that mapped out because ODFNW doesn't know where the jurisdiction of snails are. And what I found is interesting, and I didn't know this, is there a whole key, and it's like 100-and-some pages of keys of all the different freshwater snails that are out there. I just put it down. There's no way before this testimony I was going to read 100 pages of keying of what kind of mollusks are in various river systems and what they are. But I think it's important as you think about that provision, that map that was shown, the last one where we go back to the DEQ showed from 2021 on, is probably going to be a significantly bigger. In fact, my interpretation is it's going to go to wherever there are trout. And that's a pretty big distribution in Oregon rivers. So with that,
if you could wrap up, Rich. Let
me just talk real quick, if I might, just on the scientific piece. So I'll skip the rest of that and just talk about the scientific piece. This is one of the few times in the Capitol, and it continues to be, where we don't take the scientific information that's coming out at us and saying, is there an appropriate regulatory response that makes sense? I've read most of the studies, the mercury studies, the habitat studies where the mines had the tailings in the water, and a bunch of the other studies. And some of these can really be handled through common sense, as the one speaker said, regulation. And the example is this, Chair Dembro. If you just take one of the studies that talks about the tailings when they're in water and they're suctioning a hole in the substrate, and they have a tailings pile, what they found is that salmon tend to avoid those places. But if there's too dense of those types of activity, the salmon will start spawning on them. But what happens is in the first freshet, it flattens that tailing out. It's going to start naturalizing, right? And the concern is that it's going to scour the reds. But instead, we go to a ban on mining where maybe this conversation should be, maybe the miner should fill up the darn hole, right? Because then it gets rid of that particular problem. I have other examples that I put in my testimony exactly like that, where the regulatory response is more appropriate than the ban, and we've just completely skipped over the regulatory conversation, the scientific conversation. The scientific community adds so much in this building, but it should be used to first ask, can we do it better, not just stop doing it. So last thing, just on the points of the, and I was going to read them to you, but I would say that there was a biological opinion issued by NOAA Fisheries in the Rogue River Siskiyou area. They found no jeopardy. It was a programmatic permit. I have it right here. It's like a couple hundred pages, biological opinion.
And do you have a reference to that?
Yeah, and I was going to read that. So,
well,
you're speeding me through.
No, you can just send it to us, Rich. I'm sorry, but we've we have to move on.
So there's one other one on bull trout, and that's on an upland side where they issued the permit. So with that, I know there was a lot to talk about. I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you, Chair Dembro.
Okay, Senator Dembro and members of this committee, my name is Michael Hunter, and I'm a mining advocate, if you would, and so I've got some information that I really kind of want to touch base on here.
That's the report.
About, I guess, misnomers. First of all, I think that what you guys are being asked to do, your task is actually to find out if Senate Bill 3 will protect the environment. You also, and this legislature has commented on rural Oregon economy. This is one of your critical issues you guys need to evaluate as cost factors of something like Senate Bill 3. And then I think the third one that was touched on by Senator Courtney was this is a memorial, basically, for Senator Bates, and I commend that. I have no problem with that. But what I'm kind of asking is there isn't anybody in this room that wants to damage the environment. We don't want to hurt the environment. We're not interested in hurting any species. That's not even up for discussion. And as far as the rural Oregon economics, when I came here 45 years ago, we had mining, logging, ranching, farming, dairy, recreation, hunting, fishing, and eastern Oregon was not ghost towns. It was actually very economically stable. So while I advocate for mining, that's only one of the economic factors that helps Oregon. So this, I'm speaking for all of those. We're overregulated, mining is curtailed. Of course, ranching and stuff like that, they have their own issues and stuff. So there's a whole bunch of problems that are hurting our Oregon citizens. I would like to think that, you know, if we could actually get everything working in aggregate, again, mining, logging, ranching, we would be a revenue source for rural Oregon again. It takes all of them. You can't just make it on one of those. So this is an aggregate effort to reinvigorate the economies of rural Oregon. The memorial bit I'll talk about a little bit later, but Rich mentioned this letter. I have the cover letter for his 227-page thing. It's on your particular thing. It's the number one entry there. And this is a credible source. This is the United States Department of Commerce, National Marine Fisheries. This is August of 2016. And this was at the request of the Siskiyou National Forest personnel down there. And it totally addresses suction dredging, high banking. And this opinion said, this action is not likely to adversely affect, and it mentioned a type of smelt, is not likely to jeopardize the continued existence of salmon, and will not result in destruction or adverse modification of their declared critical habitats. And that's a pretty credible source that you guys, and when I talked to a few of the community members, nobody's read this report. Nobody knew it existed. 2016. I would think people would want to be informed about both pros and cons on this issue. And it bring to task, 2016, Karen Tarno, Oregon Department of Equality, Environmental Equality, she had this in her desk. I wonder why she didn't feel it was relevant for you guys to peruse this. I would ask some hard questions. I would ask why she didn't feel this was important. And again, asking hard questions, I guess. Has the Fish and Game ever actually issued you a written statement where they can definitively, empirically prove their stance on salmon habitat and destruction of by suction dredge mining? I don't think so. If they would, I'd ask another hard question. Have them define and empirically prove what they actually are claiming. And the second set in here that I put in here, there's 21 references to major critical things, including federal government, various state studies, a whole bunch of them that are actually, in fact, one of them is a reference from the Oregon State Department or Department of State Lands. And Senator Olson asked this question, that how damaging is what the suction permits and stuff like that. And here's their statement. They conducted a study in their stream systems in 1997 that these placer mining activities did not permanently modify physical habitat characteristics. The data gathered, so there's no more than minimal adverse effects resulting from issuing mining general authorizations. They've reversed 180 on that position. I'm curious why and how they could support that. These major companies, CMH2 and all of the other federal things, all of them, every one of them conclude that there's less than significant impact. Some of them actually show beneficial structures. I'm suggesting that the Fish and Game try to find one shows adverse. There has not been one scientific study that supports their position. Here's 21 that support our side. So we outweigh them very effectively. And the very last part is I'm going to now address Senate Bill 3.
If you, could do it just within a minute or two.
Pardon?
If you could do it within a minute or two, Mike. I'm sorry.
Okay, this but is we have to move one on. Last little statement here.
Great.
The terminology tributaries above, simple word above, that expands and gets everything in this state. Eventually by 2021, there will be no mining in this state. And that's going to cost the state approximately, just from the placer mining, about $18 million per year. That's what that would contribute. And so even things like, let's say, Multnomah County or Multnomah Falls, the water above the falls becomes the SH. above Detroit Lake and all of this, are two man-made dams, Big Cliff, and all those waters are become ESH. That's overreach, way beyond consideration. And then Senate Bill 3, I think history-wise, I've been informed that Senate Bill 3 was offered during the biennium, probably in 15, maybe 3 years ago, and that your Senator Bates didn't sponsor, didn't agree with that bill. He tendered Senate Bill 1530 during the short session because of the other one was too extreme. It seems ironic that you would want to make a moratorium or a memorial bill out of a bill that he didn't actually back, that he went ahead with his own watered-down version of SB 3, which was 1530, which didn't advance through committee. I'm curious on why you would want to memorialize a bill that he didn't approve of. And it's I'm asking you basically to don't advance this SB 3. It's very restrictive and very overreaching. And I'm suggesting that there is a good alternative. It will accomplish what you're trying to do. It will actually achieve a memorial, and it has bipartisan, and that's the Senate Bill 472. It has bipartisan effort. And much more appropriate what you're trying to accomplish. I thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
You need me to hurry?
I'm sorry. Yes, please.
Okay. Chairman Demno and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to comment on SB 3. My name is Larry Chase. I live in Springfield, Oregon, and spend most of each summer mining in the Baker City area. I'm a member of the Eastern Oregon Mining Association, which represents approximately 500 miners in Oregon and other western states. When possible, I have been associated with placer mining for gold since 1957. The predominant form of mining in Union, Umatilla, Grant, and Baker counties is upland mining, which means that trommel screens set up on away from the creek and the gold-bearing gravel is processed there. The important thing to note here is nothing happens in the creek. Water used in processing moves in a closed loop from the machine to at least two settling ponds and then back to the machine. There is no impact on fish. I know it is very, very difficult for people living in Portland and Multnomah County and some of the other urban areas of the state to understand that A, people in Oregon still actually mine gold, and B, that for some miners, especially the upland miners, I think, the proceeds from their mining activity is a substantial portion of their yearly income. Governor Brown mentioned in one of her campaign speeches that rural areas of Oregon deserve more help than they were getting. The use of legislation like SB 3 to impair or prevent upland mining is not helpful to the rural parts of our Oregon. These are difficult times in the rural areas, and the spending associated with mining operations is very impactful. Virtually all upland mining in Oregon takes place on federal land. The permitting process that a miner goes through with the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management is very thorough and covers all the issues that the state of Oregon is concerned about. As it pertains to upland mining, SB 3 is basically redundant. Between the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, requirements, everything that the state is concerned about as far as clean water, habitat protection, et cetera, is already being addressed. I would say if you recall the statement about from the Dogami representative that was on the panel, about what's come with SB 3 and the increased fees. If you look at how this is all handled already, there can only be two reasons for doing this. A, we're either trying to create a new income center for the state somehow, or B, we're just trying to drive the little guys out of mining. That's the only two reasons you could put in fees like that. My advice at this time is that SB 3 should not address upland mining at all. The two mining techniques are different enough that they should be handled separately rather than lumped together. And we would also like to see the operating hours, as mentioned in Section 6, page 4, be changed to mirror the rules in Dogami. I would be happy to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. Your testimony has been very helpful. Yes, Senator Roper.
Just a quick question. Dogami couldn't answer it, but with respect to a small mining operation, are you if they're telling me that the permit's going to cost $10,000 to $20,000, Are small miners taking out that much resource in their small mining effort? I mean, could they pay the permits?
That's a business. This is a risky business, and that kind of upfront cost, it would be rare, I think, in Oregon to discover a deposit that was rich enough that you could pay $20,000 up front and then pay for your machinery, et cetera, et cetera. Two chances of getting that to work, slim and none.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, all three of you. Okay. I'm going to start calling people up in groups of three, starting with those who are coming from more than 100 miles to be here with us. And I'm calling you just in order of sign-up. So you may find yourself sitting next to someone who completely disagrees with you. Please be polite and, don't kick them or whatever. So I'm going to start with John Ward, and then Rich Nawa, and then Jack Williams. Or did we already had Jack, didn't we? No? There was another. No, that was Jack Hunter. Okay, and Jack Williams. Thank you. And then following them will be Robin Jansen, Stacy Detweiler, and Jake Crawford.
Looks like you only got two coming up.
We only have two here, so let's bring up someone else then. Let's bring up was Robin next?
Yeah.
Robin Jansen, please.
Thanks.
Okay. Hello.
Senator Dembro, members of the committee, and is this on?
It is.
It's okay.
Yes.
Good, thanks. thanks for the opportunity to come and speak to you. I'm John Ward. I'm the current conservation chair for Rogue Fly Fishers, have been for a number of years. And I'm here to represent the board and our 250 members that have an interest in this issue, not just because it affects the Rogue Basin, but many of them are active outside of that area as well. What I've tried to do is not deal with the biological impacts that are better studied by others more prepared to do that than I. I'd rather look at the economic impacts because I think that we heard just from the previous speaker that there was $18 million generated from suction dredging. Well, perhaps that's so. But the only relevant comparison I know of is a 2008 study done by the Dean Runyon folks for ODF&W in looking at the impacts of fishermen in Oregon, which is significant. I've broken out those fishermen that are freshwater fishermen in the 13 counties in which suction dredging was done last year. And so I've tried to shove the others off to one side. When we look at last year, freshwater only, these 13 counties, trout, steelhead, and salmon fishing only, not saltwater fishing for salmon, 58.7% of the trips were generated around those three species, or the related ones. total fisherman travel was $103 million by the fishermen in that year, according to Dean Runyon. If you ratio that out, you've got 28.7% of the fishermen being freshwater-oriented, 13 counties that do suction dredging. It brings it about $60 million in 2008 into the state of Oregon, either from the resident people or the non-residents. I can give you the breakdown if you want on that. You could look back at the Dean Runyon study. But I think there's a significant economic impact that's imperiled by killing the babies in the gravel through suction dredging. I think we'd like to see large fish come back after the smolts go downstream, come back from the ocean, and they're a much bigger prize, or that's why the people are there. If we crush them all in the sands and gravels, I don't think that we're helping the long-run economic health of either eastern or western Oregon, because roughly half the counties that do suction dredging are over in the eastern part of the state last year, and the other half are on the western side.
Thank you, John. We're going to have to limit testimony to about three minutes.
That's what I wanted to come. Thank you.
Appreciate
the opportunity. Yeah. Any questions?
Well, hold on. Let me hear from all three of you first. Rich?
Senator Denbrough, members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, my name is Richard Nawa, and I'm here to speak as a citizen of Oregon. I support Senate Bill 3. I'm highly qualified to give testimony because I've done fisheries research about the stability of salmon spawning gravels. I've made hundreds of observations of impacts of suction dredging in southwest Oregon and reported those in two scientific reports, and I've given talks at various scientific meetings about the impacts of suction dredging. Reproduction is the most critical phase of any species life history, and I want to kind of walk you through how suction dredging adversely affects salmon spawning. So it's true that when we have high water in December and January, the rivers that were previously impacted by suction dredging are pretty much leveled out, and they look relatively natural when the suction dredgers arrive in mid-June, July, August, middle of September, where they often dredge the spawning areas, digging pits and leaving tailings. They literally turn these areas upside down, so where you had a coarse armor layer that was pretty level and flat, it's now the contours are all disrupted, and you have fines on top of the coarse gravel. The salmon, it's true that the dredgers do not dredge when the adult salmon are present. So they show up a few weeks after the salmon dredgers have left, but this is critical before there are any large storms that would level the streams again. So the salmon end up spawning among these tailings. So what happens then? So this is what we need to bring in some science to help us, and I've attached a peer-reviewed published paper to my testimony, and we have to understand the different levels of science. This is the highest standard, because this peer-reviewed independent scientist writing to a journal. It's not an agency report. It's not a biological assessment. It's peer-reviewed science, which is the highest standard. And so what did these scientists do? What did they find out after the salmon spawned in among these tailings? So go to page 616. I got a tab on there. And you look in the upper left-hand corner. There's a graph there. Is everybody finding that okay? So up there it shows a comparison of the scour, how far down the river scoured during the floods that year, where they had salmon or they had suction dredging in the areas that did not have dredging. And you look at those bars, and you can see the clear bars are where they had dredging, and they're nearly double or much greater than the natural areas. So why is this important? Well, salmon only bury their eggs so deep. And if you look at that Scott one in the upper right-hand corner, where the natural reds were affected to about 20 centimeters, and the dredged reds were affected to 50 centimeters, that means that all the eggs in that Scott River area were lost. So the female salmon puts in about 3,000 to 5,000 eggs. All those eggs are gone. They're scoured out of the reds. So all those fish presumably perished. So I highlighted in yellow the key findings, and I'll read the last sentence. These estimates and the differences in scour we observed suggest that many more pre-emergent Chinook salmon were lost from reds on dredged tailings compared with reds on natural substrates. So it's not often that you get science that's this clear, black and white, of what a management activity is doing. This is not a gray area. It's pretty clear from this publication that when the dredgers go in salmon spawning areas, that the salmon subsequently spawn, we're losing a lot of fish. Not a few, a lot. And it applies to all fall spawning fish, which is coho, chinook, and bull trout. So include bull trout, too. And so I just like to conclude to recommend that you pass SB 3. And I'd also like to comment that the moratorium we had last year I conservatively estimate that thousands of salmon are swimming today because there was no dredging or less dredging in areas where salmon spawn. And I just don't think Oregon has salmon eggs to waste on suction dredging.
Thank you. Thank you, Rich. Robin.
Hi. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Robin Jansen, and I am a river guide from Southern Oregon. I've been a raft guide for 20 years, and I know those rivers down there pretty well. This is also my third time testifying on this issue, and I really hope it's the last. No offense to all of you. It's great to see you.
All right.
But I do hope it's the last time. I'm here today to voice my support for SB 3, which would not only see Senator Bates' legacy, but would implement permanent regulatory reforms on suction dredge mining that would extend beyond the current five-year moratorium for Oregon's rivers. I feel pretty strongly about that. I depend on the health and sustainability of the rivers in Southern Oregon for my livelihood. I was going to say a lot of things. I'm going to just say a couple things, I think. I've seen the impact suction dredge mining has on the riverbeds. The science is really important, but you don't have to be a scientist to know that it impacts our rivers' substrate and fish habitat, and it impacts recreation. It impacts anglers' time out on the water. It's noisy. I've had friends fall into pits left behind by suction dredge miners. They're supposed to fill them back in. Some of them do, some of them don't. And it can be kind of dangerous for folks wading out into the waters. You can see the pits when you're sitting in a raft floating downstream. I know landowners don't like it because it's noisy again, and there's folks sitting on the shoreline on their property. So I would just say that I've seen the impacts. And not only on the main stem of the Rogue, where we don't see it that much anymore, because I think people figured out that was probably not the best place to be because it was so visible and impacting a lot of other folks, but we see it up in tributary streams, kind of way out in the middle of nowhere, where they're actually not supposed to be. And those are sort of the bad actors and the ones that I feel like these regulatory reforms probably need to be implemented upon more so in those tributary streams that Jack Williams spoke of that are so important to our main stem rivers and the habitat for sensitive salmon species. So that's kind of all I really wanted to say. I support the bill, and I urge you to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Yeah. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you, all three of you. Thank you for coming so far. So we have Stacy Detweiler, Eric Peterson, and Jake Crawford, please. Okay, Stacy, you want to kick us off?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today in support of Senate Bill 3. My name is Stacy Detweiler, and I'm the Conservation Director of Rogue River Keeper, a nonprofit organization based in Southern Oregon in Jackson County. Our mission is to protect and restore clean water and native fish populations in the Rogue River Basin through advocacy, accountability, and community engagement. On behalf of our more than 3,500 members and supporters, Rogue River Keeper supports SB 3 because it establishes long-term regulatory reform of suction dredge mining to protect sensitive habitats and streams. This bill has been considered in previous legislative sessions and represents the recommendations of diverse stakeholders from the mining industry to state agencies, developed in a collaborative process championed by the late Senator Alan Bates. As others have noted before and as acknowledged by the legislature in 2013 with the passage of SB 838, mining is part of Oregon's unique cultural heritage, particularly in Southern Oregon. In fact, gold was first discovered in Oregon in the Rogue River. Also acknowledged by the legislature under SB 838, however, were the risks that suction dredge mining can pose to clean water and native fish when those uses come into conflict. Specifically, suction dredge mining can trap and kill aquatic insects, fish eggs, and juvenile fish, as others have noted previously, smother critical spawning gravel for threatened salmon. Mining in the floodplain and riparian areas can damage stream banks, harm riparian vegetation, increase erosion, and degrade aquatic habitat. Suction dredge mining can also mobilize legacy mercury left by historic mining operations that can become resuspended in the water column. In 2013, the Department of State Lands identified the Rogue along with the South Umpqua Rivers as the two most heavily used rivers for suction dredge mining in the state. The Rogue supports habitat for the Southern Oregon, Northern California coast coho salmon, listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 1997. Under the SONC 2014 recovery plan, NOAA Fisheries identifies mining as a threat to the coho recovery and points to inadequate regulatory mechanisms and habitat destruction or curtailment from mining as factors in that listing. The current bill before the committee represents a multi-year effort bringing together diverse perspectives from the mining industry, state agencies to implement regulatory reforms that will extend beyond the temporary moratorium established under SB 838. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and we urge members of the committee to vote in support of SB 3.
Thank you. Thanks, Stacy.
Senator Dembro, community members, thank you. My name is Eric Peterson, and I come from Jackson County. I've worked as an outdoor adventure leader, as a river guide and other roles for the last 26 years, and I've worked on the Rogue River for all those years. I've witnessed the explosion of mining and then also what happened when we banned it. What I'd like to do, I'm coming to you to support this bill, and I'm coming from a place of witnessing the activities, but also I was the sole representative on the task force, governor's task force for recreation, so I'm not a stranger to this issue. What I really want to talk with you today is about values, and from my perspective, I'm also educated as a social scientist as far as how we relate to the natural world, so that's part of where I'm coming from here. Mining, motorized mining, it really embodies the values that are at the cause of climate change and the mass extinction that we're witnessing right now. And I think we need to address that. Often when I'm taking people down the river, when mining was going on, people were shocked, and they would often ask me, why would Oregon allow this to happen? And I think there's some perception out there that Oregon is some green state. So I just want you to know that there's a lot of people out there that are shocked by the leadership of the state by allowing this kind of thing to happen. And some of the questions that I've come to through this issue is, when will Oregon be a leader in a life-sustaining economy, okay, instead of in an exploitive, dominating economy where we're looking at the natural world as something that we can do whatever we want to? I'd like us to remember that we are dependent on the natural world, and that's something that I have to deal with on a daily basis, both leading people down the river and also training other outdoor adventure leaders. So I would ask of you, please reappraise the values that you guys are using within your leadership. Are they life-sustaining or not? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greetings, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Jay Crawford, and I'm the Southern District Manager for the nonprofit Native Fish Society. We're based here in Oregon, but we do work all throughout the Pacific Northwest. And our mission is to protect and recover wild native fish and promote stewardship of their habitat. We have 3,000 active members and supporters and 88 place-based volunteer river stewards who work to protect their home waters. Now, I've submitted written testimony, and so I want to be respectful of everyone's time here and definitely show support for this bill from Native Fish Society. I'd also like to comment on a couple other points that are not in the testimony, and then I'll let the next person come up. And one of the things that we're really concerned about is the impact of suction dredge mining to threatened and sensitive species, which have been mentioned today. In Oregon, those in particular are Oregon coast coho, and more importantly for suction dredge mining, bull trout in northeastern Oregon, and the southern Oregon, northern California population. And really, I'd like to see the biop, because when I was looking through the guide plan, the 2014 National Marine Fisheries Recovery Plan for the SONC, it specifically mentions as a high priority restoration action to have increased suction dredge regulations or closed areas, special areas that are put off for that, and that's to protect these sensitive species. And so, you know, as we're moving forward, we'd really like to see these species protected and the investments that are being made with public dollars to not be reversed through this process. So I'll just thank you for the opportunity to be here today and say that Native Fish Society does support this bill.
Thanks, Jake. And could you get us the reference to that buy-up?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have the buy-up, which the gentleman... But I can send you the Southern Oregon recovery plan. Yeah.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Dennis Dixon, Frank Armendariz, and Tom Quintal, please.
Mr. Chair,
do you want to go and get started? Yeah. Let me just, we don't seem to have Dennis anymore. So could we have Sam Seth, please? Thanks. Okay, Frank, would you like to start, please?
Yes. Good afternoon, Senators. Senator Dembro, always a humbling experience to be in the People's House of the great state of Oregon and have the ear of their elected representatives. So thank you very much for being here today. My name is Frank Armendariz. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I don't live in Senator Prezansky's district. I live in Senator Manning's district. But always appreciate seeing Senator Prezansky. I've submitted written testimony, and I know the diligence of this committee and that my testimony will be reviewed by everybody here and thoroughly. A couple of things that I would like to add, though, because the tourism was brought up, and I'd just like to offer some additional numbers related to tourism in Southern Oregon. It generates about $130 million a year. Curry, Jaxafina, and Josephine counties with tourism, about 16.5 million of those dollars come from people that just go to fish in those counties, and then a larger category of that, which often people who raft and just spend time along the riverside viewing get put into the bucket of about $80 million. Worth of benefit to just those three counties alone from people that come and view the rivers in their pristine states. The restoration, it's been mentioned here. It's a little bit difficult to mine those numbers out of the what's available, but I estimate that in Curry County, we spent about $15 million in in-stream restorations and habitat improvements for salmon and steelhead, and I'd like to see those dollars honored with the approval and the continuance of SB 3. Rogue River, just fishing, we just talk about fishing on the Rogue River. It's about a $15 million a year benefit to the counties down there, the benefit from maintaining those streams is fairly obvious, and it's substantial. These are somewhat dated numbers. These are probably numbers that are 3 or 4 years old now. Again, since the Great Depression, I would suggest that, particularly over the last 2 or 3 years, that those numbers have increased considerably. I've seen it in my business. I'm also a river guide in the Willamette Valley. And then, just as a comparison, because there seems to be a lot of consternation about permits and regulation and permitting requirements and fees and stuff, I'm a river guide. I've had the benefit of making a living on a couple of federally managed resources, for which I get to pay 3% of my entire income that I generate from that resource. I've paid permit fees over $3,000 in some years. As a fisherman, I'm licensed. Okay, I have to buy a license. I have a species permit. I fish for salmon and steelhead, so in addition to my license, I have to also buy a species permit. I have a drift boat and a raft, which I have to purchase invasive species permits for, and I'm subject to any of the check stations that the ODFNW has along the highways if I choose to travel out of my specific area. So I also, as a river guide, I pay liability insurance, about $800 a year, and then just a whole bunch of other county, state, and federal fees to use the variety of facilities that I entertain my people on. So adding regulation and fees, all my work is in stream. I could easily damage the environment, and I would just like those to be consistent across other users of the habitat.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Frank.
Yeah.
Seth? Hi, Senator Dembro and Roland and Przanski. Thanks for sticking around so late into the evening. This is a very important issue. My name is Samuel Seth. I'm a federal mining claim owner, and I mine full-time, part-time during the summer. Basically, there's a few things I need to hit on before I get into the reasons why Senate Bill 3 is such a bad idea. First of those is that suction dredge mining does not occur when fish eggs are in the water. It hasn't for many years, and it was outlawed before Senate Bill 838 passed 4 years ago. Not only that, but the turbidity generated by suction dredges isn't nearly enough to harm fish. I mean, if you've been outside today and seen the creeks around here, they're all running like chocolate milk color. I've never seen a suction dredge produce the kind of turbidity that naturally runs in these streams multiple times a year when there are juvenile fish in the stream. I mean, wintertime dredging can't take place because it's sensitive time for fish, yet that's the time when the rivers are flooding and when they're muddy, and somehow fish survive. Another major issue is the way that Senate Bill 838 was passed. At the time, Senator Dingfelder was the chair of this committee. And at that time, Senator Dingfelder was also on the payroll of River Restoration Northwest, taking home $40,000. This is an environmentalist organization that's focused on restoring the rivers, apparently, I mean, according to their name. But it seems odd, and I'd call it very corrupt, that an elected official would be taking money from an environmentalist organization at the same time that they're the chair of the committee that's overseeing a bill like this. There seems to be a big conflict of interest there, and I believe that that's the reason why such an extreme over-regulating bill was allowed to pass.
Thanks, Ms. Seth. I just want to say, you know, just for the record, I know Senator Dingfelder, and I know her to be a person of real integrity. I mean, of course you're entitled to your opinion, but in all of my experience with her, which has been extensive, she is really a person of integrity, and she, you know, she may have been working, and I don't know what her employment as a consultant was at that time, but if she was working as a consultant, it was because it was consistent with her beliefs. Her work here was not a function of anything related to her employment elsewhere.
Can I say that too as well? We have a unique thing in Oregon. It's not in all states. We have to vote and do our work, even if we do have a direct conflict of interest. It is required because we represent X number of people in the state. And so we have to declare our conflicts, but we still have to do our work. And so because we're a legislator made up of people who have jobs for the most part. Some of us are retired, so we don't have to. So I just want to make sure that people clearly understand. And I knew Senator Dingfelder, didn't always agree with her, but I know her to be of good integrity, and the fact that when there was a conflict, she acknowledged the conflict, because that's what we do. So,
all right, I appreciate that clarification.
There are other places where I think conflicts need, they don't have to address it, and there are places in local government where you can't vote if you have a conflict. But in the state legislature, we have to vote whether we have a conflict or not, because we individually represent 130,000 people, and they don't have they can't not be represented. So, just right. So you know, I just want to clarify the same thing.
Yeah.
All right, thank you for the clarification.
We've got that.
I think we've dealt with that. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. All right.
But thanks, then.
Well,
and if you could sort of bring it to a close so we can move on. But
okay, yeah. Sure. Thank you. The real issue here is, why are we here? I mean, we already heard DEQ tell us that they felt, before Senate Bill 838 came in, that the rules that were in place were adequately protecting the waterways. The state thought that things were all right before 838 came into the picture. 838 and now Senate Bill 3. Senate Bill 3 is the death blow for mining. It's the bill that is meant to end mining in Oregon. Not because it's hurting fish, not because it's hurting the streams, but because there are other user groups that do not like mining, and mining has such a small voice that it's hard. I mean, it's hard for the mining community to defend itself because, as you saw from the maps, it's so widespread throughout the state, mostly occurring in remote eastern Oregon or down in southern Oregon. So what we're looking at here is other user groups trying to eliminate mining for no reason other than ideological reasons. I mean, the state already felt like fish and the waterways were being protected. They're in water work periods, some of which are only 6 weeks long during the middle of the summer, that dredgers had to comply with. And now we have so many regulations that it's looking like the end of mining in the state. And I simply don't believe that that's the right thing for the state of Oregon and our rural economies. I mean, these kind of regulations just stack up on top of each other and undermine the economic sustainability of our rural areas. And that's something that seriously needs to be taken into consideration. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Quintal, good to see you again.
Senator Dembo and members of the committee. My name is Tom Quintal. I'm a small-scale miner, and I think just to speed this up, because I know time is an issue, I think I hate reading testimony, but I'm going to do it real quick.
Don't read it all, please.
I won't. Well, it's quick. I mean, it'll go fast.
Did you already file it?
Pardon?
Did you file it with us?
Yes.
Yeah, I would encourage you to tell us stuff that's not in there that we can read for ourselves.
Senator Dembro and Senator Brzezinski, yes, everything should be on OLIS now. Quick clarification. Senate Bill 838, Senator Dingfelder and I had a discussion. She called me to the chair after that discussion because I brought that up, what he just mentioned. And she told me flat out that she didn't declare her bias. And so she went to a legislative council, and it's on record. She put it in that record showing that, yeah, she was on that board. So just to let you guys know what he's saying, there was an issue. And I won't tell you all what she told me because she wasn't happy with me. But anyway, I'm 76-year-old, small-scale miner, of 30 years. In recent year, I've been participated in many, many studies, including Oregon Scenic Waters, of course, the Governor's Study Group that you attended. I appreciated it. And participated with the Oregon Legislature like this for about 20 years in different committees. And again, I mentioned that all of my testimony should be in the old system now. It's been my experience, when a bill introduces early in the legislature, like Senate Bill 3, it's usually fast-tracked. And the reason I say that is that most of the Democrats, I'm sure, vote party line and for I vote. And most of the time, it seems to end up in Ways and Means Committee. And then we never have a public hearing again on the House side. And I think that's so unfair. I truly do. I think that this is an important bill. This has been going on for a number of years. That if we can, if it goes to the Ways and Means, they all vote, and it goes to the House floor for a vote, and over Senate and House, and then on to the governor. I mean, it's just a slam dunk deal. I just don't think that's right. So I don't know what your intentions are, Senator Dembro, to run this bill through this committee, but I would appreciate possibly holding additional hearings. So if there's amendments to come forward and so forth, that would be great. So I and many, well, thousands of miners here, about 5,000 for sure I know of that I communicate with, usually weekly sometimes, are all against Senate Bill 3. In a way, I feel it's kind of a mean-spirited bill in the way that we've already got Senate Bill 838, and now we're going to shut down all the upper reaches that might, may, or could influence a an ESH stream. And why would a legislator shut down with a vote, you know, an industry that really would hurt the rural counties in Oregon, Jefferson County, Josephine County, Baker, whatever? It just doesn't seem right to me. So that's a thought I wanted to get across. This is probably the most radical environmental bill I've seen in, gosh, I don't know, 20 years working with the legislator. Now, the revenue that's lost from gold mining, and I think you probably have a copy of it, has been talked about between $18 million and $20 million, whatever. It's a revenue. And the other thing I noticed, and I know you guys know too, that the subsidies for timber has just been cut back 90%. The environmental bill shut timber off public land. So here we go. We got another hammer for rural communities. I just think it's sad.
Tom, if you could wrap up.
Yeah, I'm trying. Sorry. I'm trying. Okay. We've heard talk about how, you know, there was a big influx in mining and so forth. And I think you have a copy of this. Currently, there are only 156 permits. 77 of those permits were for five-year permits. There were five permits issued for general authorization from Department of State Lands. So it's pretty minuscule right now, and you can say, well, it's because of Senate Bill 838 maybe caused it. But the threat, I'm just having a hard time seeing where we're at with that. My main concern is this little guy right here. He's got a motor on him. Do you guys realize that to make this little tiny concentrator work, it takes a little water pump and that little motor to make that thing work? And we're talking language in a bill that says motorized mining. So to make this thing operate, if I want to put it in the stream, I have to have a minimum, if I'm in the water, a 700 permit or a 600 permit if I'm out of the water. Now, I gave Senator Dembro some permits. They're 15-page permits. That's really restrictive. It's a Federal Clean Water Act permits, the 700 MPDS. If you have the time, please read through it. It'll be on OLS for everyone. Also a 600 permit for off-stream mining. Again, 9-page permit. Now, they say, oh, there's no restrictions on what we do. Please take the time to read the permits, because we are regulated. And as mentioned, they're, I don't know, just in-water work times a whole bit. Now, there's the good things. We do remove trash, all the stuff people throw in the rivers. And so that's a good thing that miners do that we probably never get credit for. I'm not going to duplicate the studies that have been done and the one particular that U.S. Fish and Wildlife just did. But I would appreciate that you take time and look at this issue further and maybe accept some amendments to Senate Bill 3, because I think it's too harsh for an industry. I thank you for opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Senator Robles.
I just want to ask, what kind of mining, are you in water or are you out of water? Are you doing both? Okay. That's what I thought. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, and let me just say, Tom, that the reason that I scheduled this meeting so early was because, really, for two reasons. One, this is an issue that's been with us for a while.
Yes.
And I didn't want to wait to have this public hearing until the end of the session. I wanted to have it early. We will work on it after today. I will entertain amendments, certainly. And we, you know, we want to get this as right as we can.
And it doesn't have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
At this point.
And number two, I just want to say this. It's okay. Yeah. Most of us feel that when one of our bills goes to Ways and Means, it goes there to die. So, you may think it goes there to go through. We think it has another meaning. So there's a lot of meanings about Ways and Means.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all. Okay, we have John Becker. Joe McGilvra. And we have Phil Plaza. And gentlemen, again, if you could be really quick, like just a couple of minutes, because I want to get us out of here by 6.
And recognize all your testimony stays, and the other members can see it at a future time if they wish to. So.
Yeah. Great. Okay, Joe?
I'm John.
John.
John Becker.
Sorry. John, please.
Am I out of place?
No, John, okay. Go ahead.
Senator Dembrough and members of the committee. My name is John Becker. I'm a small-scale miner. I also am a fisherman. And I also feel that I am a conservationist and environmentalist. I have to wonder why this is coming up again with another anti-mining bill. And then I think, well, it's because Senate Bill 838 didn't do the job. And as we saw from the maps that the agencies provided, and the restrictions and everything else, it looks pretty obvious that that's what's happening. What a lot of people don't mention is, and something that DEQ talked about was in-water work periods. You know what those are? They're regulated by ODFW. That's when you can work in the water when there's no fish, eggs, or reds. So we're already regulated to that effect. We can't be in the water. But yet fishermen can be in the stream whenever the season is open, and they can walk on the reds, they can walk where the eggs are. We don't do that. It was also mentioned that trash gets put in the. I'd like to see pristine rivers. I like to see pristine rivers also. But what wasn't also either mentioned was the pounds and pounds of fishing lead, weights, and other things that the dredgers dredge out of the streams on a yearly basis. I've taken out pounds of it. I've also taken out some mercury. Now, miners are also blamed for the mercury. Where does mercury come from? It's natural. Takes a little bit of heat. Takes it out of the cinnabar. You find it in the river. We're the only ones who do that, clean up the river for free when we're dredging. So I strongly urge you to not vote for this bill. It's not a good bill.
Thank you, John. Okay, Joe?
Yes, my name is Joe McGilver. I live in Columbia County. I've already spoken with Betsy Johnson, your colleague. Thank you for hearing me today, Senator, and your colleagues. Today I would like to speak to you about Senate Bill number 3. I've had the privilege of working with many chemical engineers and structural engineers. I personally have a hazardous material degree and have been trained in containing and cleaning of hazardous materials. So I feel that I have a better to be a sound science behind this bill. Science is something that you can repeatedly re-quantify and is quantifiable. As an example, I drew a sample of water from the creek in front of my house right here. This was chocolate brown this morning. But as you can see, I can see you through it. It's not as dirty as it really appeared. To also quantify that, I drew 128 ounces of water, which is a half gallon, and ran it through a sieve just to see how dirty that water is. And I'm going to give this to you as an example of quantifiable science. That's what we're talking about here. We as a state need to spend our money on infrastructure, rebuilding our secondary roads to handle water and run off so that it drains cleanly. It's not just mining. It's timber harvesting. It's punching roads in through sensitive soils. It's building roads on unstable surfaces. If the drains aren't adequately designed, it saturates the hillside, and the whole roadway goes in the river. We've got a number of those in our state right now. We've had a good-sized water flow that we're seeing just how good our drainage system is. Got some bad news here for you that I'm going to submit for testimony. Thank you. Here it is. This is a toxic flow that will knock salmonids in the head and drive them right to the surface, belly up, where the seagulls and egrets can just devour them. This is how it reads. Portland sewer system couldn't handle Sunday's deluge. The sewer overflowed for the third time this winter. The Portland Bureau of Environmental Sciences said in a press release stating, starting near the Ross Island Bridge and stretching downstream, earlier overflows happened on Thanksgiving Day and on January 18th. Nearly 1.5 inches of rain have fallen in Portland, overwhelming the city's combined stormwater and sewage system at about 1:30 p.m. The city warned against contact. I was going to get you a sample of the turbidity in the Willamette River that runs past and joins the Columbia in front of my house, but I didn't want to get toilet paper on my fingers. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And if you the city warned against contact with the Willamette River for 48 hours after the overflow ends, which hasn't happened yet. It's not yet clear how much has spilled, but the city said a typical spill is 80% storm runoff and 20% sewage. Portland completed $1.4 billion big pipe project to cut down on combined sewer overflows in 2011. The Bureau said there was an average of 50 such overflows each year before the project was completed. So engineering does help. This bill, we need not spend any more money on it. The regulations that are there already are more than adequate to protect our environment. We need to redirect further monies that are being spent on this whole endeavor towards infrastructure. Let's get on board. Let's get the job done. Let's clean up the water. If you can't do it, get out of the way and let somebody else do it.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay?
Yes, please.
Okay. My name is Phil Plaza. I don't really represent anybody but myself right now. I'm taking a little bit of different tactic here, speaking to you. Thanks for letting me speak here today. Haven't done this in a long time. Preserve and protect. That's the reason I joined the Marine Corps and spent 5 years in the Marine Corps. Preserve and protect. That's the reason I joined the Volunteer Fire Department and became an emergency medical responder. And I think that's the reason that you were elected to your office, to preserve and to protect. So I'm going to go back for a while. Back in the 1960s, during the summers, my family, we used to travel all over the state of Oregon. We'd spend a week at the wet and foggy but beautiful beaches on the Oregon coast. We'd head over to the Western Cascades, dry out, camping, fishing, swimming, into clean mountain rivers that eventually would flow into the Willamette. One of our favorite places was Yellow Bottom Campground. It's on the Quartz Creek River that now flows into Green Peters Reservoir. I think many of you in this room probably know about it. I can remember spending 2 full weeks at Yellow Bottom and not seeing another camper during that whole time. We could skinny dip into that deep, clear blue 20-foot hole jumping off that huge boulder at Yellow Bottom. I taught my son how to catch fish, snagging a periwinkle and putting it on a hook and having fish for dinner. The river was clear, it was clean, it was cold, and the area was quiet, except for the natural sounds of the running river, the wind in the trees, and an occasional kingfisher. I haven't returned to that campsite until 2 years ago, and what I saw was something different. The campground is a tightly spaced campground, packed full during the summer. Along the river on Quartz Creek Road, every turnout is filled with RVs and tents, people camping along that river, and it said something to me. That river is loved by the people of Oregon. They take their family on summer vacations. And I saw something else. I don't know if it was legal or not legal, because I didn't know anything about this until a few weeks ago. But I saw several dredges in that river, and I'd never seen a dredge before. These are those floating sucking dredge operations, they're called. I think they're altering the aquatic life. I think they're adding some increased turbidity. I'm not a scientist. Other people have given you all that scientific information. But something else was happening. The natural sounds were silenced by the sound of gasoline and diesel small engines. When people go to the river, they go there to create something else. They go there to recreate something that they feel they can belong to. Families flock to that river for a cleaning effect, a cleansing effect. Let's not destroy an important resource, the clean rivers, for a flake of gold. Let's preserve and protect what we have. Thank you for letting me speak with you, and I support SB3. Thanks.
Thank you, Phil. Very eloquent. You make me want to run out to the river. What am I doing in this room? At almost 6 o'clock. Thank you very much, all three of you, for coming. Bob Reese, Nathan Dunley, and Troy Brandt, please.
Thank you.
Bob, you want to kick us off?
Good evening, remaining members of the committee, Chair Denborough, Senator Roblin. My name is Bob Reese. I'm representing three groups today, the Association of Northwest Steelheaders with its 1,600 members, Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, 35 members representing about 10,000 sport angler trips, and the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association representing over 300 businesses in the Pacific Northwest. We've been working with Senator Bates for the last 5 years and other interested parties to improve state regulation over suction dredge mining activities. The purpose of the current version of this measure continues to be adequately regulate suction dredge mining and spawning grounds and other sensitive areas. These mining practices need increased regulation because they adversely affect water quality and fish spawning habitat. It's an essential part of our region's effort to maintaining healthy fish stocks. And as you folks know, the Guides and Anglers Association and NSIA are represent the industry side of the conversation. The steelheaders, the social side of it. Sport fishing and outdoor recreation is a $2.5 billion a year industry in the state of Oregon. We also have an obligation to protect recreation areas and other special places. For example, large, noisy gas-powered vacuums can be very disruptive and do considerable damage around stream beds and banks. The increasing number and density of these mining operations has caused the situation to become a serious problem in numerous watersheds and requires comprehensive regulation. We respectfully request that you advance this important bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Chairman, Senator Roblin. My name is Nathan Donnelly. I'm a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity and former research scientist at the Oregon Institute for Occupational Health Sciences at OHSU in Portland. I'm here to ask for your support of Senate Bill 3. One particularly worrisome aspect of suction dredge mining is caused by the resuspension and discharge of mercury. Over 56% of suction dredge miners knowingly encounter mercury during dredging operations, and it is likely that more unknowingly encounter it. While some mercury may be recovered during the mining process, some of it becomes atomized or floured, broken into many tiny bits by the action of the suction equipment. It's then discharged from the dredge into the river, now in a more reactive form of the heavy metal, which can be methylated, thereby contaminating downstream aquatic and terrestrial food webs. The following is advice that the US EPA gives on how not to dispose of mercury from broken compact fluorescent light bulbs. When there is mercury spilled on the floor in a building, the last thing you should do is clean it up with a vacuum, because as it goes through the vacuum, it volatilizes the mercury into a gaseous and or powdered form, distributing it to the surrounding environment and causing a much greater toxicity hazard, even though it appears that most of the mercury is now in the vacuum bag. Simply put, vacuuming, whether it's at the home or at the bottom of a river, is one of the worst possible ways to collect and dispose of mercury. An environmental impact report by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which was peer-reviewed, came to the conclusion that, and I'm quoting from the report here, suction dredging has the potential to contribute substantially to watershed mercury loading to downstream reaches within the same water body and to downstream water bodies, methylmercury formation in the downstream reaches and water bodies, and bioaccumulation in aquatic organisms in these downstream reaches and water bodies. Seemingly low levels of mercury in sediment and water can lead to dangerously high levels in fish that people eat due to the process of biomagnification. A study done by the United States Geological Survey in 2009 found that biomagnification can result in methylmercury levels in fish that are 2 million times greater than that of the surrounding water. So I'll just go ahead and wrap up and thank you for your time and ask for your support of Senate Bill 3.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Denborough, Senator Roblin, my name is Troy Brandt, and today I'm representing the Oregon Chapter of the American Fisheries Society. And we previously submitted written testimony that follows, it's a white paper that follows our 2013 and 2015 similar efforts on the effects of suction dredge mining. Based on a review of the suction dredge literature spanning the last 30 years, we have reached several conclusions, many of which we've already heard today. First, suction dredge mining affects channel stability and habitat complexity by modifying the channel bed and removing large boulders and large woody debris. Suction dredge tailings, which are finer than the native stream bed, are more susceptible to scour. So when you have fall spawning fish species such as Chinook, coho, and bull trout, they spawn in suction dredge tailings. You may see lower spawning success the following year. Secondly, suction dredge mining can affect all life stages of anadromous and freshwater resident fish species. From direct mortality of eggs and fry that pass through dredges to harassment of migrating adult salmon and steelhead, suction dredge mining operations directly and indirectly affect fish inhabiting mine streams. Our third point, we had understood that the difference between bull trout and Dolly Varden was an area of contention, so we just wanted to clarify that bull trout are genetically distinct from Dolly Varden. Bull trout occupy streams that are characterized by cold, clear water and complex habitat. Dredging affects habitat conditions that support bull trout, including increased turbidity and decreased complexity of those habitats that are mined. Bull trout fry and juveniles are also susceptible to dredge entrainment as they tend to conceal themselves in the stream bed surface materials, especially when approached by humans or other predators. Next, Oregon is home to 10 species of lamprey, making our state a hotspot for lamprey diversity. Pacific lamprey, which are culturally important to Native Americans, rear in freshwater for up to 7 years and are susceptible to suction dredge entrainment, habitat modification due to mining, and heavy metal contamination. Lastly, although suction dredge mining potentially removes legacy mercury from mine sites, this mercury may have otherwise remained sequestered deep in stream bed sediments. Mercury that passes through suction dredges and is discharged back to the mine stream has a high toxicity and may be more easily converted to methylmercury, which is a neurotoxin that bioaccumulates through the food web. In summary, suction dredge mining has various effects on stream ecosystems, and despite the widespread practice across the western U.S., we found that the long-term effects of suction dredge mining remain fairly understudied. Dredging effects that may be most harmful in rivers and streams suction dredge effects may be most harmful in rivers and streams with limited spawning and rearing habitat that support sensitive aquatic organisms and that are impaired by other human activities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much, all three of you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, Matthew Sloach, Scott Atkinson, and Mike Hunter, please.
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, thank you for staying so late and listening to testimony. My name is Matthew Sloat. I'm the science director with the Wild Salmon Center, and a resident of Corvallis, Oregon. Wild Salmon Center is an Oregon-based conservation organization. We work to promote the conservation and sustainable use of wild salmon across the Pacific Rim. My background includes a PhD in fisheries science, and for the past 20 years, I've studied relationships between native trout, salmon, and their habitats in the Rocky Mountains, the Pacific Northwest, and Alaska. And as somebody with expertise in salmon ecology and watershed science, I'm very familiar with the scientific peer-reviewed literature that describes the effects of suction dredge mining on rivers and streams. In the interest of time, I'm just going to focus my testimony this evening on the potential impacts of suction dredge mining within the context of salmon and steelhead recovery in the state of Oregon. The Wild Salmon Center works to protect Oregon's most intact salmon watersheds before they are degraded and their salmon and steelhead populations are declining. We found that it's far easier and cheaper to protect a river before it's degraded and while it's still healthy than to try to fix the river once it's broken. And we invest a lot of energy in stronghold rivers in Oregon. These rivers are places that currently support exceptional abundance and diversity of salmon and steelhead within the state. And these strongholds are part of a conservation strategy where these watersheds that are still intact serve to anchor recovery of salmon and steelhead throughout the entire state. Stronghold rivers are identified through a collaborative and science-based process that is conducted by scientists from NGOs as well as federal and state agencies, including representatives from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
And the Illinois, the North Fork, John Day, and Wanaha are good examples of stronghold rivers that have been identified in the state of Oregon. The scientific literature has documented a number of impacts to salmon and their habitats as a result of suction dredge mining. The impacts occur at a variety of life stages. They include both direct and indirect mortality during egg and larva incubation in the stream bed. They also include impacts to the food resources and cover habitats that juvenile salmon need prior to migrating to the ocean. And as a point of clarification, I'd like to state that salmon are in our rivers year-round. We notice the adults, in particular, when they are running, but juvenile coho, steelhead, and spring chinook are present year-round in our rivers. Based on the review of the scientific literature on suction dredge mining, we believe that the activity poses a potential threat to the state salmon strongholds and therefore may make recovery of the salmon resource of the state of Oregon both more difficult and more costly to recover. And so I thank you for your testimony, for listening to our testimony this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Atkinson?
Do you want me to buy the pizza?
Sounds good.
Thanks. Though.
And the beer.
Okay. I'm Scott Atkinson. I'm a former officer, former president of Northwest Mineral Prospectors. And I started into this prospecting in 2006. That was a year after the 2005 permit was issued. And so I was working with a set of regulations that were practical, protected the environment, protected the fish, protected the eggs and fry, protected the reds, and all the stuff that DEQ and DSL and everything made us comply with. And then the snowball came. And the snowball got bigger as we got closer to the 2010 permit issuance. They were going to condition it with additional restrictions. And then the snowball got bigger. There were lawsuits filed by the environmental groups because they didn't like DEQ not putting enough restrictions in 2010 on the permit. And so there were sue and settle deals that were made between DEQ and environmental groups. There were other conditionings. Monies were paid out to the environmental groups, and then the conditions grew. So we're looking from 2010 to 2015 when the next permit was issued. There were more lawsuits filed. The miners filed as what are the, when you have two different parties filing a lawsuit, the miners filed so that we could have a seat at the table and try to have at least some kind of representation with DEQ instead of having public meetings that the miners were excluded from. And we had those meetings at the DEQ offices. We had meetings with the miners, and then DEQ had meetings with the environmentalists, but never together because, as DEQ said, we don't want conflict. So we didn't know what was being proposed, and they didn't tell us what was being proposed until the permits came out. So now we feel like we're under an avalanche. And if you guys can understand what people in a snow avalanche feel like, that's where we're at right now. We don't have representation. We don't feel like our voices have been heard. You know, Chairman Denborough, we met at the governor's work group. In Washington, we did 2 years. We spent 2 years to develop a set of regulations that have been modified once, I believe, to accommodate some changes in North Central Washington. At that work group, I brought a copy of the Golden Fish pamphlet to the meeting, and I passed them out to each work group member, and the facilitator made it a specific point to come up to me and tell me, we are not going to talk about what they did in Washington. And then turned right around, sat down, and said, but in California they did this, and in California they did that, so we need to add all these other restrictions in Oregon to match what California did. The Sierra Fund basically got all the dredging opportunity closed down in the last 3 or 4 years in California, whatever was left. And then the Sierra Fund, and I was corrected last month when I was testifying in Washington, on two anti-mining bills up there. The Sierra Fund
went and got a grant for $8 million to go in and use a dredge, not unlike our dredges that we're using in Oregon, to go in and dredge at a reservoir, and got paid $8 million to recover about maybe 2 ounces, and I can be corrected, 2 ounces of mercury out of a reservoir for $8 million. We turned in 73 pounds of mercury in Washington a few years ago and got an award from the state. That was mercury that was collected out of the rivers, mercury that was collected out of people's garages from their great-grandfathers or grandfathers mining, and we put the word out, we're collecting it, turning it over to the state so they can put it into a safe place. Now, you guys have heard a lot of these same stories for the last 3 years or 4 years, over and over and over again. It's unfair, unfortunate that Senator Bates passed away during a fishing trip. My uncle passed away in 1967 after spending the day fishing on the Deschutes River with some friends, came home, went to bed in Portland, and they went in to wake him up the next morning for breakfast, and he had passed away during the night. And so we talk about having public safety. We need to ban fishing because evidently public fishing is a
life-threatening.
Yeah, well.
It's not good for the public safety. I was in the Coast Guard, and we picked up, you know, the Coast Guard picks up a lot of bodies from fishermen that fall in the rivers. And so fishing is hazardous also.
Thanks and for that. If you could wrap up, Scott, sorry.
But as you mentioned, you know, we had the work group. We've had meetings with DEQ. We've tried to accommodate. We've tried to accept conditions. The Rogue River, the Umpqua River, and some of those rivers, as we mentioned in the work group, are not federal mining claims. Those are state waters to be managed by the state however you guys want to manage them. We don't have any mining law that protects those public waters. And so we want the right to work our private claims in the headwaters of some of these streams with reasonable regulations. And we can accommodate them as long as more things don't get piled on top of our heads. And I thank you.
Thank you very much.
I do have a question.
Yes, Senator.
I wanted to ask, I have had a hard time finding either peer-reviewed science or others that indicates that problems caused by suction dredge mining. You mentioned a number of studies. I would love to get a copy of whatever those are so I can look at them.
Absolutely, yeah, I can make those available.
I have read over parts of the studies that have been done by the department, DEQ, national stuff, about direct suction dredge mining that have said it's minimal impact, though most of them do things like tell you that you should do certain things, stay out of the river when the fish are there, to X, Y, Z. So there are a lot of regulations that they would acknowledge could be helpful to make suction dredge mining better, mm-hmm. But they haven't come out and said in any of the things that I've read that suction dredge mining done the right way creates any hazard. If there's any of those studies, that would be really helpful for me as I'm looking at this and trying to study. So if those exist, I would love to see them.
Chair Dembro and Senator Roblin, thank you for that comment. And I'm mostly familiar with the peer-reviewed published scientific literature, and they're definitely...
That's what I'd like to know where
yeah, we can get those to you.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
You know, one of the goals of the Senate Bill 838 Task Force was to use the best available science and, you know, what's referred to as the precautionary principle to try to come up with good policy. Whether or not they did it, that's what we'll have to assess. But that definitely remains my goal, at least, as we're working through this. So thank you both very much.
Well, as we're talking, you know, we talk about a lot of these guests here today talk about the Rogue River being a river of crisis. Bob Reese, my friend right here, is a CEO or executive officer for the Steelheaders organization that I belong to. We want to have fishing opportunities. We don't want the fishing to be reduced by selective harvest or whatever. We want to be able to go out and catch fish, and we want to be able to have fish in the freezer instead of catch and release only. And so the rivers that don't have any dredging on them still have a reduced amount of fish returns, and that's what that needs to be brought to the table also, because from Newport North, there is no dredging, there's no mining, and there's still reduced amount of fish coming back, and that's up and down the West Coast.
Great, thanks. Evan Roy.
Ray.
Sorry, Evan. Nick Cady. Nick still here?
Yep.
All righty then. Marianne Nash, come on up. Tom Wolf, you still here? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's it. Yes. I think I got everyone.
We can ask. Is there anyone?
Senator Dembro, Senator Roblin, my name is Eben Ray. I am a gold miner, and I'm here because I don't believe SB 3 is worthwhile. I wasn't going to speak today, and after all this, I don't know what to say. You know, somebody had said something about common sense, and that's what I'd like to see, some common sense. You saw the map. You had a few red dots, and you had a blue map. Shutting everything down. As the last gentleman talked about, the shortage of fish in all the rivers, not just the ones affected by suction dredging. It's a, whatever the numbers are, it's a small industry, I suppose, compared to the $80 million I heard that fishermen bring in. But is SB 3 protecting fish? If it is, then as somebody said, get rid of the fishermen. Is it shutting down an industry? Is that what we're after? If that's what we're after, then pass it. We'll shut down the mining industry. Everybody in this room and most everybody in this state will be affected by the mining industry getting shut down. I've been listening to people type clear through this whole meeting on their computers, and every one of those computers has gold in it. Everybody here has a cell phone when they go fishing so they can call their spouse and say, hey, I'm out with the buddies fishing. I'm going to be late getting home tonight. So we've saved a lot of lives. Another gentleman talked about extracting gold or extracting the minerals, which are non-renewable, and that's a waste of thing. No, it's not. Gold and silver have been recycled more than anything that man has. Gold keeps getting used over and over and over and is easily recyclable, and same as silver and other minerals that we extract. So you guys are going to have a headache. I know that because I do just from being here one day. A couple years ago, I was involved. I was up here quite often, talked with a lot of people, submitted written testimony, studies to look at, different things like that. And I got frustrated with the system, so I've been away for a couple of years. But I'm back today to say I do not believe this is a good bill. There's better ways to deal with it. And as another gentleman mentioned, we've got some other big problems in the state we probably ought to be working on first. I believe maybe a memorial is a good thing for Dr. Bates. My sister was one of his patients, as a matter of fact, and before he quit working much of that. But maybe we need to put up something out here beside the Capitol building to commemorate him, but not shut down an industry to commemorate him. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin. My name is Marianne Nash here on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I will be very brief because I have written testimony in the record. We have a pretty small concern with this bill regarding the definition of biological resource habitat. As you're aware, some of the habitat designations like essential salmonid habitat have also had implications for the removal fill program, which our farmers use to maintain their agricultural drainage. You all heard a lot about that last year. We are concerned that this new definition could bleed over into that program and create some expensive and burdensome permitting requirements for farmers maintaining their ditches. So we would ask that you, and we have amendments getting ready to this effect, that you would just list out the types of habitats you're trying to protect instead of creating a new habitat designation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin,
two of my most favorite senators. I'm just glad to be here late in this evening with you. You already have my my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited here representing TU. I'm going to be very brief. You have my testimony already. I have been working on this issue for a long time. I have 5 months and 3 days until I retire. And I wanted this issue to be done as I wanted gill netting issue to be done. But can't solve that one. We can solve this one. I just ask that you take the testimony of these good people that shared a concern about what's going on. We look at SB3, we make it work. We can make it work. We can pass regulations that allow people to mine but deal with some of the problems. We can do it. We can do it before I retire. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Roblin.
So we've had all the scientists and all those other people, but your trout's unlimited. So you know the difference. You can show me two pictures of a Dolly Varden and a bull trout, and you can show me what's the difference. So just, you know.
I'll do that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, all three of you. Thank you, everyone who testified. Senator Roblin, thank you for your patience.
Yep.
We will be working on this issue. You know, as I said earlier, you know, the purpose of this having this public hearing so early was to get issues out on the table and see how we can get this resolved as quickly as possible. I do believe there is a solution here, and we're going to work our hardest to make sure we get there. So with that, I'm going to bring this public hearing to a close. Senator Roblin, I'll see you in this committee again on Wednesday.
I'm not coming Friday, though.
If you were looking forward to a long hearing with respect to trapping, we have postponed that hearing. So, okay, we are adjourned.
Yeah, I was looking forward to that.
We are adjourned.
Yeah, I was-